Yeah.
All right, so I'm here. It's the day after Thanksgiving. It's Black Friday, if you will. I'm with Ryan Falk. Been a long time since we've spoken. We've known each other forever. Libertarian, from the ANCAP libertarian thing into the race realist thing, now into the whatever it is thing that we're doing. But, yeah, I noticed you talking a lot about Holocaust stuff when I got back on Twitter like a year and a half or 2 years ago. Always liked your stuff and, you know, just started messaging and decided just to talk about that for a little bit. But you had some other stuff you were talking about. I mean, I don't care. I'm willing to just talk about whatever. But I got your link.
Yeah, sure, I guess. I don't know. I wrote like a whole bunch of stuff. I don't know exactly what we're going to talk about here. I guess I'll just start off as like why I sort of changed my mind on talking about like Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. And it's two things. Here I'm going to talk about the Holocaust in particular, but also like I think that the idea of Nazi Germany as like particularly aggressive in the way it's portrayed is also another big myth. The short story is the only premeditated aggression the Nazi regime ever planned on doing was an invasion of the Soviet Union in conjunction with Poland as an ally, kind of like Hungary and Romania. But anyway, that's another thing.
And they desperately hoped that they would have an ally in Britain, but that didn't pan out.
Yeah. So why, but like first is the why talk about it. It's because it's like whenever, like, how do I put this? People who are like sort of against like the hegemonic belief system of the place and time that we're in, like they've, you know, the fact that they've learned to sort of work around the Nazi narrative. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've learned to work around it and operate sort of in the context of that.
Yes.
Doesn't mean it's not damaging. Doesn't mean it's not like this fundamental thing that you're constantly having to work against all the fucking time. And another issue is it's when you're like making like for example, I was making basically effectively white nationalist arguments. Now, whether I'm like absolutely in love with the glorious white race or anything, not sure. I don't know. But I was effectively making like white nationalist arguments. Right.
Right.
And so that is already putting you on like a spectrum in terms of like what I might call on one end of the spectrum is like argumentative strength versus sort of surface level public appeal. And those are kind of in conflict, and it's kind of a one dimensional spectrum. It's really a true dichotomy there.
Right.
And this is something that I've sort of been noticing, what the Republican Party has been noticing, is that like young people get into the Republican Party and like they're basically like 40% of them are like Nazis.
Right.
They're having a huge problem. Yeah, it's very funny. But it also points at kind of an issue of the Republican Party is that like anybody who's smart and honest is eventually going to become is eventually going to look into like the core of the religion, right? They're going to be curious about it simply because, you know, it's kind of like what you said. I care because you care. It's like,
yes,
you know, why do you care about Christianity? It's like asking why somebody in medieval Europe in 1300 AD, why do you care so much about this Christianity thing? Why do you care? Yeah. It's like, well, like, what do you mean? Why do I care? It's like the foundation of everything. Everything is a reference to Hitler and all that. And so they're going to look at that. And so this creates kind of a stupidity problem with the Republican Party because people who are smart, because it acts as a filter for people who are smart and honest.
Right.
Right. Smart and honest. And also maybe it's three things: smart, honest, and curious.
Yeah,
because there can be people who are smart and honest but aren't curious at all and just sort of accept things. But
right, yeah.
So that's sort of an issue. And so I'm thinking about like, well, on the spectrum between surface. I'm thinking like, do you want to mitigate your weaknesses or lean into your strengths? Right, because I think that like our strength is argumentative strength. Is that people who listen to the argument become convinced.
If they're capable of being convinced, yes.
Right. That's the idea, at least. And I'm thinking, you know, trying to mitigate what I call sort of first pass or first glance palatability is just a waste. It's just a waste of time, right? Because there's a whole army of people who are going to dig up like everything you've said in every chat and every and one thing they'll do is because, and here's what's kind of shitty about that. It's because what they'll do is they'll get the quote of something that you said, maybe there's a chance you didn't even say it, but like, because they have the quote, they just found it. And so it's recent for them, but for you, it's like hardly even remember it yet. Because you apparently said it, you're responsible for the quote, right?
Right. Even if you don't believe that anymore, don't think that anymore.
Even if you don't believe that anymore, don't remember it. And certain have no idea of the context. And so it's just, So trying to go for like this kind of first pass palatability is, I think, kind of like a mug's game entirely. And so that's sort of the conclusion that I came to.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, let's just go in on argumentative strength, forget palatability.
That was my take kind of like intuitively from the beginning, which I was sort of like, and it's also one of the reasons why I never really agreed with sort of like pretending that I was just a conservative to conservatives who are just conservatives, right, who are not intellectually curious, who don't like Nazis, who do like Jews, they do like blacks, right, you know, like, because I feel like even though there might be some crossover, right? Like there's probably some crossover issues that I have with them, but the things that I think that they are against, those are like deal breakers for them. And to sort of like pose as this thing that like, oh, I'm just one of you, because I see a lot of people doing this, and it seems like every new generation or crop of like podcaster, thinker, right, mostly just podcaster or tweeter or whatever, someone who's promoting these ideas, like, has this brilliant idea, like, oh, all you guys are dumb, I'm gonna trick the conservatives or something. And I did this too, it doesn't work, they're not fooled. And they'll be like, and of course now, you know, which is interesting because I'm not sure what's going to happen with the Republican Party because of the fact that basically, I mean, everyone always uses this under 30, like it's a magic number. I mean, I would actually say maybe it even goes like slightly higher than that, but let's just use under 30 for just because that seems what everyone's agreeing on, that they just don't, like, they can't get them to like Israel. And given that, right, like supporting Israel is kind of like the number one thing about the GOP, It's sort of an interesting position that they find themselves in, which I'm very eager to just sort of see how that pans out. But yeah, I always felt like for me, like I can't really convincingly pretend I'm something I'm not. And, you know, that gets me a lot of trouble even with this community, because if I think something's stupid, I just say that's fucking stupid, which is another thing that we have, those of us on this side of the, because we were talking before, are we like autistic, or are we just like really really like dedicated to the truth, or socially insensitive? Like I can be all three at the same time, you know? Like I don't think I'm on the spectrum, but I can absolutely be totally insensitive, and I really do think the truth matters in like a weird way, because people sometimes ask, like, well, if you don't really have much hope for politics in the United States, why are you doing what you're doing? I'm like, I just feel compelled to do it. I don't know, I can't explain
it. And a lot of people don't understand that. They don't understand the compulsion to dive into this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I wanted to, like, or if you're interested.
Yeah.
One thing I've been looking at with, like, because I spend a lot of time reading. Now, I'm not going to lie and say, like, oh, yeah, I've read all the Holocaust handbooks covered.
Dude, that's impossible. I've read a lot of them. But it's amazing that they wrote all of them. I mean, Carlo Montagna was like a beast. But, yeah.
I mean, I've spent hours reading them, but I don't think I've ever read one cover to cover. Because I go through and I find things that I think
I've read a few. I've read the shorter ones about, like, where they're, like, dissecting witness testimonies. Some of those ones I've read all cover to cover.
Yeah.
I did read, the one thing I actually really did read cover to cover, which they don't sell anymore. This was huge. This was a massive undertaking. It was there because I also read their three books, Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor. I read those cover.
Yeah, the Reinhardt camps. Yeah,
those are good. And then the Holocaust, was Holocaust Controversies blog wrote like a response to those three books, and their PDF response was like 500 pages. Carlo Montagna was like, he was basically saying, I'm not going to debate somebody. I don't do internet debates, and I'm not going to do like an online debate because it's not permanent. Like, if you're going to put, and I understand why he did it, because when I debated Cockrell, I kind of wanted the same thing. Like, you got to put down, like, I need to know what you're going to debate, right? Because I don't need you shifting around in the middle of it, right? And right. So they did publish a PDF. He's like, all right, well, that's permanent enough. And then they published like a 1,400-page, two-volume response. And I got so engrossed in that because I love the format of not just of like responding to somebody. Like, here's someone, here's why everything they said was bullshit. And I just couldn't stop reading it. It was a joy to read, even though it was really long. And I don't know how many people could actually read through all of it. Right. But given the form, given that it wasn't like dry, like, dude, I have their Einsatzgruppen report book. I can't get through it. Dude, it is like, it's not like it's intellectually above my weight. It's just like, it's like 800 pages of like dissection of these mundane reports that is just like, wow, I don't know if I could actually sit down and read that. But yeah. So those I have
well,
done.
I mean that's the kind of evidence you'd expect from the biggest mass murder in human history: reports, testimonies. And,
yeah, but they don't really show
reports,
that
testimony, and documents. Like, you're not going to expect, you know, mass graves, right?
Right.
Because they burned them all.
Yes.
Right. You know what's funny is that in 1943 the Jewish Telegraph Agency that's reminded me. I should have put that on my list. My little link dump I sent you, but anyway, in 1943, they actually were sending out messages that you're not going to find bodies because the Germans burned them all. Right?
That's
so they're
funny.
They're already preempting. Well,
the Jewish Telegraph Agency is a fantastic resource because their website even today goes all the way back even before World War I.
Yeah.
So I'm writing right now, and I know people are going to break my balls because I've been promising it for like a month or so now. I am writing an article about the Havara Agreement and why the typical narrative on the Havara Agreement is bullshit and why it was like totally like not even really a thing. And, you know, I've read like liberals that are pro-Palestine. They say like, oh, and they want to paint Israel as Nazis. They're like, Adolf Hitler and David Ben-Gurion like agreed on this together. I'm like, that never happened. Like, that's ridiculous. And the Jewish Telegraph Agency is invaluable because they have all like the data year over year for the numbers of people that went and the accounts in the Havara company in Jerusalem and such. And it's nothing. It's like tiny. Tiny amounts of money relative. So
yeah, I remember something on Yad Vashem where Hitler actually proposed sending over like trading Jews, like sending Jews to Britain in exchange for like trucks and stuff.
That's funny. I've never heard about that, but that is funny.
For war material. But I'm just thinking, like this kind of goes into the I can build a better gas chamber argument.
Mm-hmm.
The I can build a better gas chamber argument isn't just about I can build a better gas chamber, but I can come up with a better way to get rid of Jews argument.
Yeah.
If I really wanted to. I'm just thinking, like, if I'm Hitler, I'm super tempted to just round up all the Jews, put them on like, because the Germans actually had a lot of like these merchant ships, which like obviously weren't doing anything because they couldn't sail and ship stuff around the world at that point. They're completely blockaded.
Yeah.
So what I'm tempted to do is just say, it's just a Hitler go into like the Reichstag, like pump up the radio towers to like the illegal. The modern day illegal wattages that they used at the time to blast messages into Britain saying, England, we hear your cries. You are, you know, you lament our treatment of the Jews and you wish to treat them better. And I would round them all up, put them on barges and just send them to British ports without asking. And then it's like, okay, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to sink the ships?
You're going to send them back. The other thing you could do.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Send them back? You just ram them there? You crash them on the beaches?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Cuban.
Just ram them in,
Cuban flotilla style, or you know, or you could. I mean, if you wanted to even get, I mean, it was funny about the. I can think of a better way. Like when I interviewed Fred Leuchter a couple years ago, and he talked about him going to Auschwitz and then look. You know, he was literally an expert in killing people. Like in like state mandated killing, like not like murder, but like you know, he was absolutely an expert in this. And they pretend you know, the Jews that went after him, they pretend like that wasn't true. It's like, oh, they went after his educational credentials. Like, well, at some point, his professional history seems to come into play. Like, this guy designed electric chairs. I mean, he's kind of a weird guy, like designing execution equipment. But, you know, someone has to do it, right?
And, like, that's the kind of guy you want to talk to about mass killing up.
That's what's funny about it is that he actually isn't that hesitant to talk about killing people as a result of this. And one of the things he said is, like, I do not think you can kill huge numbers of people with gas. He's like, if you want to know what I would tell you, put them in an abandoned mine shaft, blow it up. And I was like, all right, guy. I mean, all right, you know, given that, like, nobody's actually doing that, like, okay, yeah, sure, we could theorize. But yes, that probably would work.
A hundred better ways to kill.
Well, another thing that's funny about the Treblinka thing is, like, why did you even use gas? The rooms were sealed. Just leave them in there. People will all suffocate eventually. If they can't get out, like, yeah, why even bother with the gas? Because if it's sealed, so, I guess, you start pumping gas and you're actually going to blow the door off at some point.
So anyway, I guess, like, something I looked up, and this isn't the link thing. I looked at modern prices for the cost of manufacturing carbon monoxide and hydrogen cyanide. Mm. And hydrogen cyanide is like, it's like 10 times as much per unit of, like, in terms of per unit of lethal dose, right? So it's, carbon monoxide. But I think this understates the cost differential at the time, because you remember Germany at the time, because of the fuel shortage during the interwar period, they had actually developed
wood gas, like,
a massive amount of wood gas and coal gas.
This is really dangerous, but nonetheless, you gotta do what you gotta
do. But they had these machines that were just like carbon monoxide.
They had lots of
producers, just everywhere.
Lots of carbon monoxide on hand. Yeah.
Yeah, so and so that's one issue. Another issue is that we actually have, like, the actual, like the undisputed, in any sense, homicidal gas chambers the Germans use in Action T4, where they use carbon monoxide. And of course, carbon monoxide, when you get carbon monoxide poisoning, you kind of drift off. You don't panic.
Right.
So
what I hear, cyanide poisoning is very similar, because it does something similar in the blood. Like, so you don't, it's not, it's like, it is actually, like, it does, it binds, it's sort of a similar death. Like, it binds to your blood and doesn't let you absorb oxygen into your blood cells. But I don't know. Well, but well, no, the difference is, I think, what's funny is, then you have all the testimonies of people turning green and blue, and that you don't do that. Like, people
the testimony is that they were all panicking and screaming and stuff. So
yeah, that's true. Well, also, I mean, look, we can go through this is fun, though, because this is like 101, but it's just basic stuff, which is, like, if you never thought about it. But this is the other thing. It's sort of like, when you think about it, first of all, most people don't know what the narrative is. Right. So one of the first things I do when I discuss this with people, if I've got somebody new on the hook about it, is I'll say, like, you don't know what the Holocaust is. Yeah. And they'll say, well, yeah, but I'll be like, no, but you don't know what it is. Like, you tell me. And I remember I had a whole Twitter conversation with a guy who wanted to debate me on it, actually. Hilariously, he wanted to debate me on it. Okay. And I asked him, like, I was going to do it, but he was on some random liberal guy on Twitter. He bailed. He just, like, stopped responding to texts. And I knew that was going to happen. But I was just like, okay, so you just actually describe, like, what it is. And a lot of times people don't understand the question when you ask that. And so I'm like, okay, no, what I mean is, like, how did it work? How did it actually function? And even Matthew Cockrell, when I did a debate with him a few years ago, which kind of turned into a shit show,
because it's a lot of people.
He wanted to avoid. Yeah, he desperately wanted to avoid talking about gas chambers, and sort of Grandma Rudolph always says, you know,
that's like the core.
First of all, gas chambers are the core, right? And so I always insist that we're going to talk about that first before we talk about anything else. And this usually is enough to scare off any potential debaters, because they don't want to talk about it. And then just the how do you get the people into the room? Like, how do you do that? And particularly, we have some testimonies. If you pour through the you know, the Armreg books, which, by the way, is a sponsor of TRS. They do what we do. But again, I absolutely use their product, so I don't feel bad telling you to go and buy some of their books. So go to armreg.co.uk. But this, you know, you can find in them, like, stories of, like, oh, there's, like, four SS guards. I'm like, right, so four, even, like, the weakest people, you can't force them 2,000 people into a room. So they overshot, like, you know, that's just right away. How would you do this?
Yeah. I'm not sure that's a terrific argument because they could go, well, we could overpower the four SS guards, but then what? It's kind of like it's the reason that criminals don't shoot at individual beat cops, right? Because sure, right. maybe they could kill that one cop, but that doesn't. But now,
yeah, and it's also
the cops are after
knowing them. A couple guys that have been COs. I've asked about this, and they're like, "Well, it's you're psyching out, and in prison, you're dealing with blacks, right? So these are people who are less low impulse control, right?" So they might do it, right? And oftentimes blacks do end up fighting police and attacking police because they don't conceive of the, well, the police have, they're just going to have, infinite police, right?
They have deep reserves.
Yeah, yes. And you know, a lot of blacks don't realize it. Like, we used to joke, like, they think it's always just one-on-one. they think every fight's actually just one-on-one because they can't conceive. But, but yeah, and he's like, yeah, you're kind of always, like, psyching them out because at any one time they could just riot. But they don't usually. So I understand that, but I think it's not so much the overpowering of the guards issue as it is, like, first of all, if you know you're going to die, that's when you actually are now put into a situation where it doesn't matter what's next, right?
Because they don't know.
But supposedly that's they don't know. But then they do know, right? So it depends on who you ask, which is another problem. But then, because when you read some of the stories about how some Jews that tell, like, oh, how they helped put their own people into the gas chamber. Until, like, some really sexy Jewish lady, like, distracted a Nazi and they all ran out or something. You know, some of this kind of stuff. But how do you just organize it? Like, how do you just actually march them in how do you even get that many people into a room that size? Because it's, like, packed shoulder to shoulder. At some point, it's going to be like, why are we doing this? Like, what's...
Yeah. So, I see, So what I'm thinking about with this... with that kind of argument is so there's an issue with, like, when you're dealing with an audience is that the more that when you escalate complexity, certain audience members, the argument will become so complex that they can't follow it anymore.
Right.
And once they get to that point, they'll default to heuristics, which means authority.
Yeah.
So I see that kind of argument as getting too in the weeds.
Okay.
That's why I kind of like, so when people, like a lot of the Holocaust 101, I kind of like big, simple arguments.
Okay.
Right. That's what I sort of see. So, like, for example, the East Shift and the Soviet and the autopsies, right? Larson and Gordon going in, autopsying the bodies and saying, oh, not a single gas body found in the West. Now, first of all, you could say that's not going to mean much to what I call, like, L2 orthodoxy, who sort of understand the narrative, but to normies who go, wait, no gas bodies found in the West,
and then
they learned the East Shift, the Soviets didn't allow, and that's actually, like, a revelation for people.
Yeah,
I remember, you know,
I think the number of people who are what you would call L2. What do you call it again?
L two. There's L1, which is like you go to middle school and you see.
But as you said, the people who do know the narrative, I think there's more deniers than there are of those people.
Oh yeah,
there's significantly more Holocaust deniers than there are of people who are, like, L2 believers.
the only people looking up crematoria. It's all.
Yeah, it's like crematory. I actually, you know, it's funny because that's an argument I make about the cremation thing. Is when people talk. Now, it seems to be a thing. It's sort of funny because there are like bad arguments, right? And one of the worst ones is, like, chimney to nowhere. I hate that because that's just normal. Like, it is normal for a smokestack to be disconnected from a building. And I remember when I had, like, the revelation of this where I was actually just, like, at a factory.
Sure.
Like, I was just, like, outside a factory and I was like, oh. And I was like, wait, smokestacks across the parking lot. Okay, yeah, that's a fucking retarded argument. And so, so that's really stupid. Now, it seems to hit, like, a thing in people's brain because they think, oh, a chimney and a chimney, smokestack, whatever, exhaust, pumping gas out of a room.
Yeah.
That, it's like, to them, that's what they know is, like, a chimney, right?
But it's fragile. That's a fragile thing.
But as soon as that
contact with an L2.
Yeah, and it's or just any engineer who's ever worked at a or anyone's ever worked at a factory or yeah. So it can that one you can easily be like, oh, there, and then they'll look like people giving that argument are full of shit, and they'll look like a bunch of like cranks, right? So I don't like that
Mike
one.
Mike was like, you said something wrong about thing, therefore thing happened.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's how it's that's going to work, right? Whether it's fair or not. So,
yeah.
So yeah, I don't do that one. But I also think then the crematoria, like, and then estimating like how many could have been killed and then how many could have been burned and how many could have been cremated. This, I think is something you'd have to be talking to like an L2 about, because I think for that's going to lose people. Like Carlo Montagna wrote 1500 pages on this. Okay.
Yeah.
Like I don't actually have those books, but like, look, it's good to have the work done, but yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know what that's like? That's something that funnily enough, and I think maybe sort of important. I don't know your position on this.
Okay.
But one thing about the point about like regarding the Nazi regime is like oh, you're saying Hitler didn't do this and this. You must love Hitler. It's kind of like people accuse Bob of you know raping little kids. And then I go in and I say, and I look at the evidence and I say, well, it really doesn't look like Bob was raping little kids at all. Okay. This all looks like lies. And people go, oh, you must just love Bob or something. Right. Or really like Bob or really be like pro Bob or something. And the absurdity of this can also be pointed to like with, you know, Saddam Hussein, right. Because you can say, like, because a lot of shitlibs were saying,
oh, dude, this happened to me at 20 years ago all the time. Yeah,
a lot of shitlibs at the time, and they ended up being correct, not because they're deep thinkers, but because they're reflexive. But they ended up being correct about Saddam not having a gas or nuclear or whatever weapons program they were saying. But that doesn't mean they love that they're Baathists or something.
Well, as opposed to me, where I did love Saddam Hussein. I didn't give a shit one way or the other, frankly. I didn't care about him at all.
Yeah, I mean, well, frankly, I think Saddam was a stabilizing force in the region. And
well, at that point, he was, whatever. Yes. I mean, of course, he had been, you know, there's a lot of history there, but yeah.
I support Iraq from kind of a real politic standpoint, not that I'm in love with Baathist, whatever. But anyway, so yeah. So that's sort of the, but I think like, one thing, and this is like kind of like the big problem is the TDC problem is that you know, testimony, documentation, confession, and it's like, and so basically I think you can kind of invalidate all of that like in class, as opposed to having to go through, you know, because the thing is the Orthodox people, they have like huge budgets, they have huge foundation, right. And also, frankly, I think they make up a lot of stuff, which is another issue. And I think that the revisionists, they respect it too much.
I know what you mean.
And instead of just class dismissing this entire evidence, because if you take a look at like confessions, and first of all, even in like sort of within the box of like the L2 Orthodox narrative, like you have plenty of people who made false confessions according to the modern narrative.
Yeah,
right?
There was a guy. That's something that can work, is if you tell like things, like if you can tell someone the, you know, things that they used to, they haven't gone back on their own word.
Right.
One thing that actually, when Stryker and I were actually teaming, like gearing up to do the team, it was supposed to be a team debate.
Like Huss's testimony was filled with just massive overstatements.
But and they'll admit this, but one of the things that actually even a Jew was affected by this, when Stryker and I were teamed up, we're going to debate Cockrell and this guy Avi Bitterman. Now Avi Bitterman punched out because he thought we were like Ernst Zundel watchers. Like literally he dismissed it. He's like, okay, I'll send you what I've got and you can send me your like Ernst Zundel videos or whatever. Like, so he was like nothing. He didn't take it seriously. And when we actually had a Skype call with them beforehand, and it was such a shit show. It took them like 2 years to turn in what they were going to turn in for the debate. I thought they were all just chickening out. In that time, Avi Bitterman had actually chickened out. He wasn't going to do it. But Stryker told him, I remember this, well, you know, the Majdanek numbers have been reduced now to like 40,000 or something like that. And he was like, he was himself like, what? And he it was like, that's official. And that was actually really shaking it to his confidence, because it's just another check mark in our box. Real quick, another thing I think the so-called revisionists respect too much is like denial of the word that they are deniers. But it feels weaselly to say, to play around with words to me. And
I
could see kind of like both sides, because I know that Germar, who is a friend of mine now, I've actually gotten to know him. He really insists on, he doesn't like denial. But I'm like, I don't know. I am kind of just like saying this thing didn't happen. So I don't shy away from denial.
Yeah, but like, I mean, but also denial has like implications that there's like clear evidence right in front of you, and you're just sticking up your head and going, no, I deny that water is wet. You know, that's sort of the
I hear that. But revisionist sounds too, I don't know. I mean, maybe we just disagree on it, because it sounds too, weaselly to me. Like, I'm not trying to get out. Out of something is my point.
Yeah. I'll just say both. I'll just say like revisionist, or if you want to use the pejorative, denier, whatever. I don't believe in thing. I disbelieve in.
Yes, I don't think thing is true. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, yeah, whatever you want to do with that what you will. You know.
Yeah. So. But like my view is that like so if we just take like say like TDC, so if we just look at confessions, so first we have like the orthodox established false confessions, right? And that and there's a little bit of legwork to sort of collect those things, but that's all done, and that's all scattered about the handbooks and stuff, and of course just the known use of coercion. So I've actually gotten was actually pretty brave with my family, which I kind of use as sort of a touchstone of like they've become a lot more conservative since Obama.
That's a very normal pattern.
Yeah. So my family was like they were like, and I say this to people, especially like Zoomers, and they're like a lot of them just don't believe that this was that, like, what are you talking about? But like, there were a lot of guys in my family who were in the military, but they were all Democrats. But they were like patriotic American Democrats. Yeah,
that's something that used to happen.
That used to exist. And people, there's like, no, that's not, what are you talking about?
Now,
and I think there was even some Democrat candidate in the primary in 2016 who was like that. And
yeah, Mark Kelly.
Yeah, I was like, you're a relic. What are you?
No, there's actually, no, it was Jim Webb. And there's another guy that's the governor or senator. His name's Mark Kelly. He's governor or senator from Arizona. He's like a Jim Webb type. Now, that still kind of exists, actually. But it's mostly focused in, like, the Air Force and the Navy. And, in fact, you know, I was talking to a guy, actually, the other day who was like, saying he was an ex-Air Force officer, and I was like, oh, really? So how's your boyfriend? And he was like, fuck you, fuck you. And like, you know, I was like, and he knew, he laughed though, because he knew the bit, right? He knew that and I was like, well, okay, but is it true, right? And he's like it's like half true. And I was like, all right, that makes sense. So like, they don't like wear it on their chest. They do. There are like military people that are still like liberal, but they, again, everyone uses military to enhance whatever their politics are. But it feels like, because it's a clout builder, right? But it feels like that there's more credibility to doing it for someone who's like a flag waving rock rib conservative than like a libtard trying to do something like gay and libtarded with it. But that still happens. But yeah.
But obviously like the people I knew, they weren't game playing. They weren't
right. They were just in the military. Yeah.
In the military and believed in like, and by Democrat, it was like, you know, working class politics and, you know, billionaires being too wealthy. It was all like economic stuff, right? Which is increasingly going by the wayside.
You can't really find it as much anymore, although there was some of that. There was
Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street, was that like the last gasp of like economic?
Yeah, but that was not something accessible by actual blue collar people. You know what I mean? Like, Occupy Wall Street was a privileged college kid thing. It really was. Like, I lived in New York at the time, and I would go down there and make fun of them.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, it was not, like, if you were like a blue-collar Democrat, like, from Pennsylvania or something, from Pittsburgh, you would be alienated by that. Like, you wouldn't want anything to do with that, you know, because you'd all be, like, these weird anarchists and shit. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What do I have written down here? Yeah, another thing is, like, the Nuremberg trial rules was something that, like, that's a 101 stuff that I found to be, like, really effective. It's like saying, it's like, yeah, they just assume it, and you know.
Because people are used to
these things.
If you can sort of shock...
the trial established that it happened. It's like, no, it was assumed that it happened, and they're trying the individuals.
Right. And I think that taps into certain ideas, like, average Americans have about, like, impartial justice and stuff, which is, of course, nonsense, but, like, again, people think it, you know. Right. What it does, anything that will put, I think, the people that want to promote it in, like, an immediate defense mode, which is, there's actually quite a bit of things like that. The Nuremberg trial rules are definitely one of them. And actually, it's funny, just this morning, my wife was, I you know, arguing with Grok. It's kind of like, all right, but, you know, it's a girl, so whatever. What?
Don't argue with an LLM.
Eventually, LLMs will start to agree. But the funny thing is, this was sort of funny because it was like, it was insisting on... it's actually valid. It's actually valid. She knows not to argue with an LLM. She was doing it for other people to see it. So it's basically like pointing out all the things, but they're not allowed to. And it's like, you know, the weasel words it was using. It's been trained to do that, of course. What's funny is, you know, you can get any funny.
It's more than training, but
there has to be determinative programming in there, because you can easily... The way neural networks work, which I know as a former computer engineer, like, I've looked into, I've learned, I know how they work. You can talk to them long enough, they'll lose original context, and they will start just doing what you want.
Yeah,
the context
acts as a kind of on the fly, in practice, reweighting of the neural net. Think of the context window as kind of a life history of it being built up.
You can talk to them long enough that you will reweight all that stuff out, though. If you and sometimes you don't even have to. Sometimes, actually, ChatGPT will just tell you what you fucking want to hear. I mean, I got ChatGPT to tell me Kevin McDonald was right in, like, two prompts.
Yeah.
So,
but the thing is,
I mean, like, I wasn't impressed with myself. It just was something I did.
Yeah. They're not like. Yeah, so LLMs have extreme prompt sensitivity compared to humans, and like, because they have to, like, relearn so much and, like, so quickly, because they don't have fast permanent weightings, right? Because basically the human brain is like an LLM that fine tunes every second, right? So, and they don't have that constant fine tuning.
Well, they also don't, as you said, permanent biases either, right? Like, the biases are still somewhat ephemeral. So, like, people have very strong, not just ways, but, like, permanent biases where you're just, like, not overcoming it. And the LLM eventually can overcome a bias. But anyway.
I don't want to go down.
We don't need to start explaining how neural networks work. I find it fascinating, but it's like, it's a fascinating engineering problem. It's not, you know, it's not something that...
Sure. Well, I also have some really, I don't know what you would think of this. I have some really, some ideas that there actually is a phenomenal state, but that's
not... Oh, what do you mean by that? Like, there actually are become alive or something like that? Or I don't know what you mean by
alive, but I think that there is that there is phenomenal states, and it's a really complicated, it's a really inferential thing. Obviously, it's not anything that a human can empathize with, right? But I think I'm hard on that.
So yeah, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, I'm just like, no, machines aren't like us. This is all statistical weights. Like, this is all numbers. We just don't know exactly what they are in any one case. But
Well.
That's me. We could discuss it sometime. It'd be interesting, but we're talking about the
Holocaust. Sure. We could discuss it some other time.
Yeah, exactly. Time. Exactly.
But anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, so I think one problem with, like, Holocaust revision up to this point, and frankly, I think that the frickin' library of content that they have is good to exist to point to. And I think what I was, when I was talking about Hitler, One thing that I recall Hitler saying, and I don't remember exactly where he said it, but he pointed out that the communists, by having Das Kapital, that was a valuable thing for the communists to have. Mm-hmm. Not because anyone read it, because nobody freaking read it, right? Same with Christianity and the Bible. Nobody reads them.
Yes.
Some people do. But just having but a book that you can point to, right? And that's what sort of exists with revision, is that there's this
I think he did library. Say that. I think it was probably in Mein Kampf, because that's really the only definite thing that he... Well, I mean, there's Table Talk, which I think is pretty well evidenced as being legit, and there's a couple other things, but yeah.
You think, okay.
Well, I think it's mostly legit, yeah.
I just don't like the story about how it was found.
It's a little weird. Like, well, there's two versions of, there's a real solid one, and then there's stuff that was like, that's more apocryphal, that was like found later, but there's some stuff that's very solid in my opinion. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to go and look at the text history again. Okay. But that was my opinion upon reading it. And also,
if it wasn't found all at once, then that opens the possibility of some being real, some being fake.
Definitely some of it's real. I have no question about that, about some of it being real. And it also reflects what I think are actually Hitler's beliefs. And generally speaking, you know, I do like Hitler. And again, I'll say whatever I want, right? So it's whatever. So I defend him, and I'll defend even some of the things he said. And people will... One of the things you get with Hitler is this idea that, like, if he said anything negative about any group, that means he wanted to kill all of them. Right. Yeah. So if he says, like, you know, Russian peasants are kind of dumb, which is, let's be honest, is true. Like that doesn't mean he wants to kill them. In fact, he very much says the opposite. He says, well, that means what we should do is we should basically give them enough to feed themselves and be happy, but we don't need to educate them or anything. You know, something like this. Right.
There was like some SS like official document of like racial groupings or something, like the party's definition of races and stuff, and basically like in it basically said Slavs are Aryan,
yeah,
like to the Urals they're Aryan.
They wanted to Germanize them, right? Which is frankly some people find that really offensive.
That's not a Nazi thing. That goes back to World War I.
That's been a thing forever. Just like, I also think that's not genocide. Like that's a very different thing, particularly when we're talking about the white race. You know, you're talking about people who are generally racially compatible. You're talking about linguistic, cultural differences. There's genetic differences too, but that's much more fluid.
And like a pan-European white nationalist just doesn't give a shit.
I really don't actually care. Like it doesn't, like if you're telling me, but they're going to, what, like they're gonna take Eastern Europeans and elevate them to a higher culture? Like, yeah, oh, what a terrible fate that would have been.
Or lower, or you could say it's a lower, but it's not their culture.
I'm a part Slavic, and it doesn't bug me. So, like, you know,
at the very least, it's certainly not genocide.
No,
in terms of what they were.
Well, it's also not something that the United States doesn't talk about, because the United States Americanizes and assimilates. Right. So if you're going to criticize, because that's effectively what we're talking about. You're talking about Germanizing means, think about the idea of people talking about how is America going to assimilate the immigrants. You're talking about the same conversation. So if you hate that, then okay, like have at it, you know? So, yeah.
Right. So one thing, like, we talk about Table Talks is like, sort of gets into like documents. And like, I've sort of developed like a radical skepticism to just all documents about the Holocaust.
Yep.
Period.
Yep.
And that's something that the revisionists, I think, they should do, right? You should have this radical skepticism. And also it's a, like a strategically effective thing to do, because otherwise you're going to go, because the funhouse never ends.
I know exactly what you mean. Now they have this idea, and I'll give you an example. They have this idea.
Who's they?
The revisionists. Generally speaking. And I mean, I know, as I said, I've become friends over the last year with Germer. I've been, you know, I've actually met him in person. He's a very nice man. And he's a very serious guy. Like, he is, like, formidable intellectually.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
And I've read some of his work.
Yes. And so, and that's fine. And so it's sort of like, it's good to have all, I think no matter what, the library they have, as you say, even if no one's going to read it, pointing to, you know, there's this, and saying to people something like, you know, there's more work done on this Like, they've written far more pages on this than the people promoting it ever have. And if you say, like, oh, well, look at Raoul Hilberg's book, only 20 pages of it are actually about the killing system, right? Because he basically didn't ever talk about it. So they've got, like, 50 books.
Pages about mind reading.
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, in terms of the radical skepticism of documents, now they feel like they're kind of losing. I know this. They feel like they're losing the game. One of their algorithms, if you will, when going through a claim, it's like they don't want to immediately say a document is fake. And I used to believe in this because I used to think, like, all right, well, if I just come out with, like, that's fake, it's kind of a weak position. And I think it depends. Sort of, it is.
But you don't say that. You don't say that. I mean, you say in the first place, like before ever talking about a document, you need to talk about two things. And I've actually did a link of that, and it's actually a CODA thread that goes into people talking about the forgery workshops.
Yes,
in Germany at the time, and the Jewish displaced person camp, and also other and there's also mention of others. There's a whole bunch of reference.
Okay, is this a documentary evidence one?
Yeah, like manufacturing evidence. It's
right.
In the.
All right, I'll.
I think
I see it. It's yeah. Oh.
But it's referencing all sorts of stuff that I'm gonna that you have to I'm gonna have to track down. So that document is just like, here's a potential place to look for things, to find things, whatever. But yeah. So just good doing that and pointing out the forgery workshops. This gets into so you just pointed about that. And another thing that I thought
was the fact that they would do this thing in terms of submitting documents where all they had to do was say, this is a real and true document. I say it's real and like sign an affidavit and like they never had to present an original of it. Right. And there are documents. I remember I went through one several years ago when I was first getting this, called like the Frank Grisch report, which is like, it's totally fake. It's like, and the fucking Holocaust controversies people claim they eventually got the original, but it was the original one from Nuremberg, which wasn't even presented at Nuremberg, probably because they realized it was stupid. But it's literally just, and here's where I basically won this argument, because they were doing the thing that was dumb or that is unbelievable, because I was basically like, well, this is literally just pieces of paper with German text on it. There's no identifying marks. There's no pen writing. There's no signatures. There's no seals. There's no official letterheads. There's nothing. Right? Yeah. There's nothing. It is just... So what the hell is this? And what they did...
And I would say, I would say who cares? But anyway.
Well, I like the argument, though. It's also, on some level, who cares? But on some level, I enjoy the argument. But... But what's funny is their response was like, well, we can prove that this was typed on the same kind of typewriter that Frank Grisch, who was some Nazi official, would have had in his office. And they went in on the Holocaust Controversies blog, attacking me with like all kinds of, you know, obnoxious derogatory language. Like typewriter. I don't give a fuck. I think I saw that post.
They showed the typewritten letters on this kind of typewriter compared to.
Yeah, we called it the Frank Grisch End Tower. That was a video we made about it, because I was like, dude, no one. Like, this is actually discrediting that you're doing this, because this is the level you had to do.
They use the same typewriter.
How many typewriters? Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I'm sure thousands, if not tens of thousands of such were produced, you know?
Yeah. But also, like, in terms of forgeries, I in my mind, I'm always thinking about, like, what if I had, like, 2 hours to sit some people down, you know, and make, like, the presentation?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm always thinking. It's maybe it's not the most realistic, maybe, you know, but that's, like, what I'm thinking of. And I'm thinking, like, you want to go over the sophistication of hoaxes. So, like the Mussolini diaries, nobody really talks about them because they didn't get anywhere, but they're actually quite important, right? Because the Mussolini diaries, they were immediately spotted as fraud, but the reason they were spotted as fraud is not because they failed forensics. They had all the right materials, they had all the right letterheads, the handwriting was perfect, it failed because Mussolini was saying that I was doing things which we know he wasn't. So it failed on content, right? And failed on content plausibility. The Hitler diaries are the opposite. The Hitler diaries, and the Hitler diaries were just, were enormous, right? And really incredible. And they, right? It, and obviously past handwriting is just nothing. Like
handwriting analysis is bullshit. Form. It's pseudoscience. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyone can passing handwriting is child's play. So,
but also like, but the, you could be but a handwriting analyst. Handwriting analyst is fake, and it's just a way to. It's like if they have an agenda. I mean, sure, you can get like a Jewish handwriting expert. That's like, yeah, that's definitely. I mean, you know,
fake,
like, yeah.
Well, I don't think you need to even make that argument. It could, because we've had known fake documents that passed handwriting analysis. Yeah. So they can pass it. Who cares if handwriting analysis is real or fake? They can pass it. Whatever. But the Hitler diaries failed on material. They failed on forensics, and which is to be expected because they came out a lot later. Mm-hmm. The Mussolini diaries came out like in the like 1953 or something. Mm-hmm. But the Hitler diaries came out in the 1980s, and they actually passed most of like forensics.
At that point, it's like, is anybody believe this? You know, I don't know.
Lot of Irving believed it. At least at first.
Yeah.
Now, he was also one of the first people to say it was fake as well. But a lot of people believed it initially. But the reason it failed was materials. There was like, it had the wrong stationery. I think some of the paper had like something wrong or something. So this creates a problem, right? So you have a fake that passes forensics but fails content. Then you have a fake that passes content but fails forensics. So what then is a real document?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's also the question of like...
You know, a fake that passes both. And more recently, there was this guy who was like some historical researcher. I linked to that book. He was looking into the Mengele diaries. And these Mengele diaries, they were the effort put into the fraud of this was breathtaking. It had his diary, sure, but they also had all sorts of like notes that were attributed to Mengele, like oh, this is a little note that I found from this document here, and this is a little thing, oh, this is what I found from his office over here, and there's little handwritten things, and then there's notes like saying like just writing down times as like, you know, and then like a diary entry saying, oh, I ate this or this.
Yeah.
And so it just unbelievable levels of integration of everything. And the way he found, and he was doing forensics analysis, and it was like passing, I think it was passing handwriting. It was also passing forensics, I think, for as far as he was concerned. But the way he found that it was fake was that there was one slip up, which is where Mengele referred to a phone number which had an area code that did not exist at the time. Mm. And that's how he found out that the whole thing was fake. That one little slip up, but people like in terms of fakery. I think having like a little presentation of just the scale and the scope of the Mengele diaries and the Hitler diaries.
There are some people that still want to rescue these things.
It's breathtaking. It's breathtaking. The scale of fraud, like just how there deep are and there is
a,
it is. They,
this is a profession.
And people just don't believe it. Nobody could do all like.
I mean, Norman Finkelstein, no way all this is by fake. Calling like, his yes. book the Holocaust Industry. I mean, he didn't even get into this level, this side of it, because he thinks it's true, or he says it's true. I mean, I don't know what. Maybe he suspects. Who knows. He probably knows that Jews are capable of this if he's Jewish, but like, nonetheless, it's like even just that term though is good to have out there because that it is an industry, and there is like, and there's more than just the industry of using it as a tool, using it to bludgeon people and bully and blackmail sure. and extort.
There's
right?
also like financial rewards.
Oh, there's huge. Well, this is the funny thing is that there's just it's obvious that. This is a funny thing because there's like the content of popular narratives and then like the actuality of it. And Jews constantly do this thing where they're like, oh, poor us, like, we're the only ones you can beat up on, we're the only ones you can bully. And, like, they do this constantly where they're like, oh, if this was a, look at this, someone's posting, these people protesting outside a synagogue because of Israel's genocide, right? Oh, they would never do this for a church, they would never do this for a mosque, but the Jews, no one cares. The Jews, no one cares, which is, like, it's retarded, right? I don't even need to, we don't even, but they do this all the time. This is a constant thing with them, where they promote, and it's sort of like, this must be a thing in people's brains where it's like, do you ever analyze whether that's true or not? Like, why, if that were really true, you wouldn't, like, I want to say this to people who want to, like, be Jew defenders, right? If that shit were true, you wouldn't want to be a Jew defender. Like, if they were really the despised, you would do whatever you could to show that you also despise them and not be seen to be associated with them because you're a normal person. You are social.
Despised people don't get a pity party.
Right.
Despised people don't get pity parties.
Right.
Oppressed people don't get to wear the badge of oppressed.
Right.
Oppressed people are called oppressed.
And this is something that, you know, I don't know how effective this is or not. I mean, I talk about this a lot because I'm talking to a converted audience mostly, but it's like, it's a thing that makes me think a lot because it actually enrages me when I see people like thoughtlessly repeating these things for status, not knowing, like, it's obviously not true. Like when,
it's like saying I'm taking a brave stance against racism.
Yeah. I need to stand up for like trans because no one else will. It's like, what? It's really powerful for people that are like conformist and want to be special though, you know? And the Jew thing, the Jews are, I don't know, you know, who knows whether the Jews know they're lying or not. I don't know. Kevin McDonald thinks they engage in significant self-deception. I tend to agree. I'm sure there are some that absolutely know they're lying. But like these types of things are just, it's just like wild. And it's sort of like, you know, I don't know what it takes to break people of that, if it's possible, but that's something that's like, you know, if these things were real about Jews, like you also would hate them. You can't come to me and tell me like that you're brave or special for like, you know, it's like I'm the one guy, you know what it is that like, and what's funny, actually, this is sort of a funny story.
I'm the one guy who defends Jews.
Right. I'm going to stick up for them. It's if they were really as despised, you wouldn't be sticking up for them. If there was no rewards, you wouldn't be sticking up for them. You sense the reward. And you know, you sense the social reward for like Holocaust stuff. When I was a kid in school, I went to high school with a lot of Jewish kids, and every one of them did their school projects on the Holocaust all the time. They were always in front of the class, and they were always like, "Oh, we can't be silent. We've been silent too long." Like Greg Johnson told me a story, which I don't know if it's true or not. Okay, but it's a good story, so I'm going to repeat it. I think it was him that told it. Where we used to have like meetups in New York City, whatever, just white nationalist meetups. I told a story how he went to like pretending to be Jewish or just showing up at some meetup at a library in New York City because he lived in the city back then. He sat in on it and then he just decided to just troll them a little bit and say, you know, just we have to actually get up and stick up for ourselves. Like we have been taking it for too long. We Jews are always taking it on the chin from everybody else, and like everyone was like clapping for him, and he said he was like secretly like dying laughing inside. And I was like, that's a pretty funny story. So I guess if they're doing it in private too, like you know, they fool themselves, I suppose. It doesn't really matter, but it's like a thing that's it's hard to get people to. It's like, dude, like. You realize you are doing. We are very familiar with this because it applies to the racism thing and all the other things. Yeah. You're not the special one you think you are, but it particularly applies to this Holocaust shit, though.
Yeah. So I also like an argument that I sort of came to. Like it's an argument that I sort of initially resisted because it felt quote unquote unfair. To make sort of in my mind. And so humans have like a weird sense of like sort of fairness.
Yeah.
It's almost like reality ought to be a symmetrical winnable game.
Yes. Oh, I know.
Right? And that's sort of the weird thing. And even I have it. So I at first didn't want to come out and make this argument, but like the logic compelled me to it, which is that documents that paint the Nazis in a black light are inherently suspect.
Oh, I agree with that.
Document documents that paint Nazis in a good light are inherently credible.
Well, that is actually a heuristic that is used by professional historians in all other contexts.
Correct.
Well, yeah. now they will do more examination, but like evidence against, like, you know, like they'll tell you this, like if there any other area of history, who is the person, if you can track down the person to whom the document is attributed to or that wrote it, and is what they're saying something that they would say that helps their case, or is it, and it's, you don't even have to, even if the document is real, like whether or not you're suspicious of the content of it, right? What, because people can lie, yeah. Even 2000 years ago people could lie, right? Yeah. And they could write those lies down.
Yeah, so, even a genuine document could say things that are
right,
wrong.
Yeah, and this is what historians have to deal with. And so they've actually done, there's been revisionism and everything where like the Emperor Caligula, where they're like, he might not have been what he said he was, because these stories of him being a child-eating monster and a pervert and a rapist and all these political enemies writing. You know? Yeah. So like, you know. Yeah,
and you should have a base level of skepticism of anything that's fantastic.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Which the Holocaust certainly is fantastic.
And it's sort of like, the Caligula is now like a literary character, right? Like people just like the character, the mad emperor, like this crazy evil guy. Like it's a good story. It's really good. I mean, people have written novels and books and plays about it. But historians are now like, yeah, it's probably bullshit.
Right. And also and also the average Joe isn't ideological about it and isn't going to like push back.
Oh yeah, no. If a historian's like, "Oh, we don't think that's true anymore because it seems like bullshit." People are like, "Yeah, I can see that." Okay. I can see that.
so yeah. But yeah, but that's kind of like the vise of documents that have come to is that like, and you know, I can see the response is like, so wait a minute. So basically revisionists get to use documents to help their case, but we don't get to use documents to help ours. It's like, well, yes, because of means, motive, opportunity, and evidence of fakery, and the fakery only goes in one way, right? Yeah. It only goes one direction.
Yeah, I actually say this is legit. There's enough,
and it's like, fake, and it's like that's something. But life, but like the real world isn't meant to be some symmetrical, winnable game. It's like this is just the vise of reality that is a result of this current situation.
Well, in a way, right? I've actually sort of already been sort of doing that, because when I see certain things, like talking about, like, say, the Frank Grisham report, which we talked about a while ago, when you read it, it's like, this is bullshit. This is, like, you just, what it's actually in it is nonsense, right? And what's funny is it's nonsense on its face, and it doesn't match up with things that are sort of, like, known to be written by him, which don't say any of these things. And they're claiming, oh, it was a secret addendum, like, which again, okay, so now you're adding
a lot of problems.
Right? So if they're, because this is the argument that he went to visit Auschwitz and he issued a report back to home base or whatever in Berlin. And then he also then, but that, and that contains all this. This is something that maybe, tell me what you think. The fact that they actually are telling you there's like secret language in all of this stuff. I think obviously that's inherently bullshit, but like, maybe that on some level, like, it seems credible to normies that, like, don't think about it. But, I don't know if you could, but it also taps into that conspiracy. Like, I always say, like, people ask me, like, Mike, you know, why aren't you, like, well, people that believe in other conspiracy theories ask me for solidarity. And I'm like, I don't believe in that conspiracy. That's bullshit. Like, this Holocaust is much like what you, it operates like the flat earth. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Well,
one thing that I think is kind of a, might be a bit of a compelling argument, because I actually made this argument. I actually had Jews like the post where I said the Holocaust forces everyone to be a conspiracy theorist, and maybe you don't like that because on the one hand, right? Because if you believe the Holocaust, well, now you believe that this Nazi regime was doing all this mass killing.
A conspiracy theory,
and effectively getting away with it, like for the most part, they were getting away with it until, as the story goes, the armies arrived and caught them in flagrante delicto, and that was that.
But they didn't even do that. That's not. They don't even. They didn't. They later on, like, they didn't even catch them because all the bodies were destroyed. Yeah.
I know. But that's sort of the story. But then, if you look at it a little bit too closely, then it. But that's sort of the L1 story
is that the U.S. soldiers, when they liberated Auschwitz, saw all the emaciated Germans and couldn't believe what happened, and then they found the gas chambers and uncovered all the U.S. soldiers. Yeah, the black U.S. soldiers.
black U.S. soldiers at Mydanek.
I love
in
that
Belarus.
When Anthony Blinken was telling that story about his like his stepfather, his dad, or his whatever, like some grandfather, some one of his elder relatives was like rescued by black soldiers in like some. And I remember I went. And I was like, all right, well, I'm gonna fucking tear this apart, right? This is known bullshit. So I was like, all right, so let me find, what were the black regiments? Where were they? And I was like, oh, yeah, the closest one was like 600 miles from where you say your grandpa or whatever saw the stars and stripes through the woods, is hiding in the snowy woods of Poland, and he sees, and then the friendly Negro like lifts him up and says, welcome to freedom or something.
I did like a little thing with them. I don't know if you've seen that documentary, Liberators Fighting on Two Fronts in World War II, where they have the where they document the black regiment that liberated some camp.
No.
Oh yeah. Anyway, it turned out to be like completely.
Of course,
like,
it's totally made up. Like,
yeah, it's totally made up. But what was great about it, and what I love about that documentary, is that they have the reunion scene where like all these older black soldiers who were in World War this was made in like the '80s or something when they were still alive. And they were meeting up, and like these Jews were crying about like, yes, I remember seeing this man who was there. And they were nowhere at the camp. They were nowhere near there.
Yeah.
And so it's like, so now that's interesting. Now I don't want to get into from like a presentation standpoint, I don't have to answer, oh, are they fake crying? Is that like, it's kind of difficult to fake cry the way they were. Or are they? Or do they genuinely misremember it that way or whatever? We don't need to answer that. We don't need to go into like why are they saying thing that clearly did not happen. We don't have to say why. We just know that they are and that it happens. And more importantly, it happens in a convergent way, right? The testimony converges, and it doesn't have to be true.
The convergence of evidence narrative is bullshit, particularly when we're going like years after the fact, and the longer you get after the fact, the more a conversion narrative it does, because we know now, we also know, again, whether or not they know they're lying or not, the testimonies converge more and more as time goes on, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. At the beginning, there was a wider,
it was all
variety
over the place, right? Yeah. And now it's sort of settled on something. And there was sort of another burst of stories coming out, and I guess maybe the reason for this was because this was in sort of like the '80s, and it could have been because the Holocaust denial / revisionism was gaining popularity and had some proponents. But again, Jews, if they find out that it existing at all, are going to overreact to it relative to how its actual penetration into the public mind. But there was a bunch of new testimonies that came out in the '80s. And of course that they can all be discarded immediately. Right. I mean, like I have to do 3 shows a week. We go through all this stuff, right? It's fun. And people that like it and people that are on, they want, this is really popular content. This is some of the most popular content we do.
Yeah.
So on some level, like, I'm not even arguing with the outside world anymore. Although I will sometimes, but I do tend to be one that I like the analyzing. I like the going into it. I like to see like, oh, that can't be true. That can't be. That's just how my brain works. But yeah, I mean, I think there was this like burst of it, and it's like some kind of Jewish patriotism, they internally feel like they need to shore this up because it felt like it was under threat. Like, my opinion about David Cole is that he was just getting out in front of the thing that he thought was fake, because the thing that he knew was fake because he thought the whole thing was about to get busted wide open, and
he
now
underestimated Jewish power,
he underestimated his own people, and then now he's like, oh shit, and now he just attacks. He can't really go back on any of the Auschwitz stuff, but he does the typical thing, which is like, oh, but like Action Reinhardt is real, and Action Reinhardt is even more retarded,
so another thing that I looked into, and this is something that I think should be done more of, is like getting outside, like sort of in talking about other things outside of the, like, directly dealing with the Holocaust. Like, because one thing that is an important, almost like an important lesson, is the Russians in England. And I did like a little video on that. It was basically this belief at the very beginning of World War One that there were about 250,000 Russian troops that were sent from Archangel up to like Edinburgh in Scotland, and that they were trundling through England on their way to the Western Front.
Yeah, and, I think I've heard something about this.
Well, I did a video about it, and I've talked about it multiple times, and maybe someone else repeated it or something. Because I haven't heard anybody else bring this up in relation to, you know, the problems with convergent testimony. But it's not just convergent testimony. I mean, there was this study, and it was just one study. And you think about it, like if they poured the efforts into finding, you know, mentions of the Russians in England in 1914, obviously, like that they do into the Holocaust, they would find a lot more of it if they search for it. But just like this one study, they found like over 500 written accounts of like, oh, you know, and accounts from train conductors saying, oh yeah, I was shipping Russian troops on my train, prostitutes saying they slept with Russian troops, you know, various innkeepers saying, oh yeah, the Russians came in, they sat down and described them in stereotypical like Cossack ways.
Right.
You know, priests at the time were credible and they were saying that they saw him. And they also had British officers say, don't tell anyone this, but yeah, we're going to surprise the Hun on the flank with these Russian troops coming in. That may have been some deliberate psyop by the British to try to fool the Germans, but in terms of building a case that it was there from TDC, testimony, document, confessions, that's a piece of evidence. Then you also have Italian reporters. There was an Italian investigative journalist saying, oh, I saw them. I saw them in the south of England. They're reporting there. And then in the initial offensives, Germans on the ground, it's now generally considered that they came into contact with Belgian troops and were unfamiliar with Belgian troops, then said that they came into contact with Russian troops. So we had German units on the ground reporting contact with Russian troops. We also have a German spy in Britain at the time who reported, you know, all sorts of train logs, schedules, where they're departing, when they're going to arrive. So you have this massive convergence of evidence of multiple different sources saying that there are Russians. There were about 250,000 Russian troops in England on the way to the Western Front. And no, you can have that level of convergence of a thing that's simply not so. And that's an important lesson. An important lesson on this stuff. So
yeah, I mean the idea, like, testimony is always the weakest form of evidence if it can be considered evidence at all, and that's how things operate today in courts. And not that courts today are perfect; they certainly aren't. But
like L1 Holocaust people just don't know that the Holocaust is based on TDC.
Yes, they assume, like, again, I remember I did this post years ago on
the bodies. You saw the bodies on the film. That's
actually the most convincing thing. And it's like, you know, and of course, when you say, well, do you know where those bodies were? Do you know who was in charge when that happened? And it's like, do you know what those people died of? They died of typhus. The Americans or the British were in charge. Those people digging those pits, those are Americans and British dumping them.
Something like 3,000 autopsies randomly sampled autopsies. Yeah.
No, they were all
not a single
disease.
Gas body.
Yeah, they're none of those
not
people were gassed, right? Body. Well, you wouldn't expect it given that the Allies were in charge of the camps at that point and typhus was running rampant and of course, you know.
There were autopsies of bodies that had died that were buried before they had taken over the camp.
Oh, so they weren't dug up and burned then, yeah. Right. So,
yeah.
So they missed a few, I guess. Yeah. But
quite a few.
Yeah. No. I know. It's sort of like. But yes, they don't. That's why I usually lead with, do you even really know what it is? And they think, you know, I did this post on 9gag years ago where I did this classic, right? And you know that there's like something that's weak here, and I know people get like, oh, like the wooden door thing, but it's like you don't even have to go like the wooden door, right? Because one of the things they say is it's like when you show the whole wooden door at the Auschwitz one gas chamber in, you know, the one in the first camp, not in Birkenau. And it's all decrepit and rotted out or whatever. Oh, that's not the original door. And in a way, that's almost like okay, fine, but like, what was the original door? Was it any different? No. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter. They get mad about it because then you show, and Grandma Rudolph has this in his book, and I just took a screenshot of it, and I put it, and I cleaned it up a little bit, and I put it on, take out some of the complicated language. I just put it on 9-gag. And I was like, you know, which one is the German gas chamber?
Yeah.
And everybody was like, of course, the one that was from a U.S. prison. I was like, that gas chamber can only kill like one person at a time. And that's you, that the this is the one that killed all the Jews. And people were accusing me of lying. And I was saying, you're going to want to watch out because I think Holocaust denial is illegal in your country. Like, and you know, so I was like trolling them, but it's like, yeah, this, and it went like 2000, comments on the, you know, I wish I could, I mean, this is like several years ago. I don't know if I can find the thread anymore.
Yeah.
I think eventually it was taken down maybe, or my account got banned from that site for that one. But yeah. But it was like just the visual, right? Like here's one that actually kills people that we know, and here's like this basement or this just dingy room, right? And
And I think of the Holocaust. It's like at Nuremberg is like they're talking about human soap, and then like one of the guys at the trial he showed trays. He presented the trays in which the human soap was made,
and I'm just so thinking
about.
Ridiculous.
I'm just thinking about like in like for like little kids in Halloween, like you know you put the, like you put their hands in like peeled grapes, like here's the eyes, put them in spaghetti, here's the organ. That's just sort of the level of like the lampshade made of human skin.
Yeah, I mean
the
that's
shrunken
stuff.
Head.
Well, the whole thing with that, I mean, the whole Buchenwald table of horrors, you know. I mean, again, what is effective or not, I don't know.
101, but it's like, I think it's effective. I think it's like,
well, you think like
it's not going to sink it all at once, but it's like.
Well, do you think telling people like, oh, that
you know, here's
Buchenwald,
the establishment of lies.
Oh, yeah, well, telling the people like that's not something they say anymore and that you can like establish that they don't say that anymore. But then what you have to do. Because they'll try and pretend like they never made a thing of it, which is not true. So then
well,
you have to.
There's freaking propaganda films about.
Right. Well, the whole
at Nuremberg.
And not only that, they did the Table of Horrors, right? Like the Buchenwald Table of Horrors, where they actually took Germans.
Yeah.
And they basically did a psyop on Germans to make them go and look at it. And this was actually done by the psych ward department of the army, which. You know who was a high ranking officer in that? It's like Sigmund Freud's fucking grandson.
Yeah.
So again, like these things, this is maybe that might be getting like too detailed for some people, but like to me, that's just another thing, right?
I found a film, a weird film from the USHMM, that wasn't used in any propaganda reels. Well, part of it was, but. I wish I could find it. But basically it was of a, maybe you've seen it. I think I might have it somewhere. It was, so basically there were these US soldiers and they were in this room and they had like these, I don't know what you call them. These sort of ventilation tubes. I don't know if you've seen them like in gymnasiums, like ventilation tubes. Yeah, but they had these ventilation tubes and they had a wall in the back and the wall was clearly like had a whole bunch of handprints in it from like when the cement was wet and stuff. And they were blowing out like this like white smoke stuff. But the guys were in there and they were, and you could see them on camera in the room filling up the white smoke. So obviously it was like steam or something. And I'm looking at that and I'm just like that really looks a lot like, you know, gas chamber like 1.0 that never made it into any. I'm see if I can find.
Was it probably Dachau? I would guess because Dachau was.
No,
they have
a whole.
Like you probably know all this. They have like the fake. The claim was they built one, never used it.
No, this was apparently made while they were before they even. This was made in 1944.
Oh, okay. So even all right.
I'll try to find it. I couldn't download it. I had to like screen record it on my thing.
That's crazy. Yeah, no, I don't think I have seen. I have seen the the stuff that the army produced from Dachau before they abandoned, they basically abandoned that one.
Maybe this is it.
Because that stuff was, well, maybe, I think it could be, because I think they did occupy Dachau in 1944.
No, they didn't get it. They didn't even get into Germany until.
Okay, right.
45. Got it. Let me see. It's like 300 something megabytes. If I can find a way, I'll find a way to send it.
Send it to Mega. Mega or something like that. If you have a link to something like that.
I think my Mega may have expired from not using it so much. I can probably send it to you over email.
You could probably get a large file to upload thing, something. Like, you find something. But that's fine. It's not a big deal. You get it to me at some point. We don't have to show it this show, but yeah.
Yeah. But that was something I just thought of. Another interesting thing.
Would you have Telegram? You can send it on Telegram. Maybe. Man, I don't know. Again, if you don't.
Let me just see if I can send it.
I doubt Twitter will let you, but that would be hilarious. They might, actually. Twitter might.
It might. I think I was able to upload it as a post, so I might be able to send it.
All right, see if you just send it. Twitter is crazy.
It's letting me send it. It's going to take a while.
That's all right.
I think it's letting me send it, yeah. Okay. So anyway, but while it's sending, another thing that I looked into, this is sort of along the lines of I can build a better gas chamber, mm-hmm. which I talked to Eric Hunt. And he really disagreed with the "I can make a better gas chamber" as like an effective.
He's completely.
Thing.
Is what's? I mean, when did you do this? Because I thought he just completely went back on everything for I don't even know what reason.
No. He's back. Okay. I mean, obviously that. I mean, look, we know what that was. We know that he was saying that because he was getting pressured.
I know what that was, but I also know that. I avoided him because Ryan Dawson told me, like, when I first started doing this stuff.
Okay, well, I don't want to talk, like.
It doesn't matter. That. Whatever. He wanted to, like, debate me or something from the perspective of, like, denying it or telling me that I was wrong. And I was just avoiding him for that. But that was years and years ago. So, yeah.
Okay. I probably shouldn't even mention it. Like, one thing he just said, he said he doesn't think "I can build a better gas chamber" is a persuasive line of argumentation. I think it's super persuasive because it's.
I think it is, but I think I don't know if there's really a rule you could build for what is and isn't persuasive. I think it might be too many different types of people are going to be persuaded by different types of things. I think because. Now, one thing is interesting, would be interesting to look at, would be sort of some of the, as we said, like the less bad arguments, or like the bad arguments that nonetheless stick around and become like memes, right? Like, for some reason, as I was sort of getting at earlier, for some reason, like the cookie monster, I can bake this many cookies in this many ovens. Now, but that's like a meme, and I don't know if that's really effective, and I know that like people that have famously done that have then gone and said, oh, that's just a meme, I actually believe in the Holocaust, so...
It's infectious. That's an infectious thing, but I don't think it's a persuasive thing.
Yeah, and I think those two things are different, and people maybe sometimes don't get the difference.
But I just have a feeling, and maybe I'm just weird or whatever, but I think that like carbon monoxide versus hydrogen cyanide, just first off, just how much better carbon monoxide is at killing large number of people cheaply and without them panicking or whatever. And we don't even have to get into whether or not cyanide poisoning causes panicking, because the testimony said it did.
Yeah.
Right? So the orthodoxy is that it does, so we don't have to go down that road, because we're basically doing the exterminationists' work for them to even make that argument, so don't even bother. But also, and it's cheaper, but another thing you know, maybe there's something wrong with me or whatever, but like, you know, because I was sitting here and I was thinking about like, okay, so if I wanted to kill a large number of people.
Yeah, that's not, people do this. Like, that's not that unusual.
Yeah,
like,
obviously people do this. And I was thinking, well, maybe the piranha solution, like that's what the Mexican cartels do.
Oh, really?
Then I was thinking, Yeah. But then I was just thinking, well, but that's...
You know what's funny is I've developed...
It turns out that would be, like, really expensive to do.
Yeah, that would be... Because you'd have to get them in... Particularly in Germany, where they're not native.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny, because I...
No.
I have developed a sort of atrocity story immunity from doing this stuff, where I think that's just not really... Like, so many things aren't really true. Like, I was... reading about the Holodomor, and look, I think that there were people that were starved to death, but there are tales that come out of that. One, the numbers probably are. I actually use this argument against Cockrell, and I use the fact that, like, you know, Robert Conquest went for years saying that there was like 20 million killed, and it was always challenged, right? Now, that became a number in people's imaginations, but no one in academia believes it, right? And then some of the stories that come out of it. Now, there's no question that there was purposeful mass starvation. That is true. But there were stories about them taking Ukrainians and putting them in a church and lighting them on fire and stuff. And, like, I just don't know that I doubt it, you know? And there's an even particularly egregious book, which, again, it's written by some U.S. military officer, and it's very pro-Nazi and anti-communist, anti-Bolshevik. And anti-Semitic to some extent. And he talks about, like, oh yeah, they would cut people's stomachs open and make them, like, run around a tree, like, wrapping their intestines around it. And I'm like, yeah, no, nope. I'm dismissing that right away, because you're just dead. That person's just dead. No one can get their stomach cut open and run. Like, they're just dead. Like, they're going,
You know what I like? You know, I think it would be good to have the presentation is that was it Metonio who did Made in Russia, the Holocaust?
That's Carlos Whitlock Porter is the name of that guy.
Carlos Whitlock Porter, yeah. Okay. And anyway, but I was reading through it, and of course I was, like, kind of chuckling all the way through it. Mm-hmm. But what particularly made me laugh about it was that and this is pretty good, is that he would intersperse, like, bands that would play. Like, and they would play, and as soon as they finished playing, they would all be killed, right? According to the story, and then he'd go through a bunch of story, and then the band would come back.
Well, Carlos Whitlock Porter is sort of unique in that sphere, because he's a very sarcastic, and he had that wry, sarcastic British sense of humor that, like, Metonio does not. That guy is dead serious, and Grandma Rudolph does not. Like, and so on some level, you know, like,
oh, the band's back.
Oh, well, they were the way that some of these stories would be like the revelry that was going on, and it's just crazy. it's like, and the scene is, like, so chaotic. Some of the scenes that they paint, it's like, oh my god, what is going on?
Obviously that's like the ridiculous testimony. Like, that's infectious stuff. That's not necessarily, like, super persuasive. But it's still pretty good.
But hear me out, though, that the fact that has been popularized, and it's been popularized enough in, like, online right-wing subculture, particularly with white guys, because the other thing is, let's talk about, like, young white guys. Like, you are used to just being shit on, right?
Yeah.
Like, whatever anybody says, like, your personal experience is one that you're low man on the totem pole. Like, you really are. And, yes, you're smarter, and you... parents probably have more money than, like, a black person or something, but you know how you are treated socially. You know how you are portrayed socially, and you know what your chances are. So for you, for that type of person, this is also why, you know, 40% of people that age are, like, identify with Nazism to some extent, or just don't like Jews and don't mind being called racist or whatever. So then you just have an experience that, yeah, everything about me they tell is bullshit, so yeah, fuck it, right? So that is, on some level, like... But the infectious stuff, memeing it year in and year out, as we've been doing, almost it's sort of like memeing because we've now been doing a thing where we've actually run out of material, where on Halloween we'll just do the Halloween Holocaust special, and we'll read like the most horrific, gory, awful tales. And, like, I feel like doing that year after year, it paints the whole thing as just, like, just gives it this whole air of, like, it's all bullshit, you know?
The baby skeet shooting.
Throwing babies up and either shooting them or bayoneting them. Or, I mean, we did a whole year of Mengele special one year, was all the stuff. And how every single Jew had a personal encounter with Mengele. And
he was everywhere.
He was in so many different jobs. And
I think Mengele became, like, the spooky villain because of his name.
Yes, no, yeah, exactly, because like, it sounds like Mangler.
It sounds like Mangle.
Yes, yeah, or Mangler, there's no question in my mind.
I think that's all it is.
We have been saying this on, like, I have actually been saying this. Me and Alex have been saying this for, like, 4 or 5 years at least. Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like Mangler. And that's why, or Mangler, it sounds like evil. It sounds evil.
Mangler.
Sounds
sinister.
Right. And so, like, and even though he actually, when you look at pictures of him, it's sort of funny. And in the way then you have portrayals of him.
He looks like a dorky guy.
He's just a normal person. Right? He just looks like a regular person.
I
mean,
he just looks like.
And I don't even think he wears glasses. Like, so when you, and of course you're going to have like the typical German Coke bottle, like circular Coke bottle glasses, you know, where you look like pedophile glasses or whatever. And so it's like, that's just, the Jews are really good. Now, when you have the bully pulpit and you control the media, it's easy, right? Like you can imprint whatever you want in people's minds and particularly through popular entertainment, it's easier.
And apparently like Mangala, like there was nothing about Mangala in like 46, 7, 8. You look at the engrams, there's just like, Mangala wasn't even anyone until like, the '60s, like maybe there's some in the '50s, but like contemporary is just nothing.
Well, the fact that he escaped to Chile, I think, or Chile or Argentina, one of the two, I can't remember. Yeah, he was down there. Sure. He was in South America, and they didn't start going for him until like they eventually didn't get him, because he did drown. I think by accident himself. Now, the reason I say that is because the Jews at that point, the Israelis, would have just, they'd be like, yeah, we killed them. They would have zero, they would be like, yeah, we violated Argentine sovereign territory and killed a legal resident of your country, and go ahead and do something. Because they do that shit all, they don't care. Like, they wag their fucking dick about that, about being able to violate all norms all the time. Like, literally, no one else, no other country, even the United States, like, wouldn't do.
Yeah, I mean, they'll host, like, pedophiles and stuff to escape.
Oh, I mean, we know that they're happy doing the only country they're a little bit hesitant about doing that stuff with is the United States, but the United States will ultimately do whatever they want. I mean, that guy Jan Demjanjuk, actually, when you talk about the Jews inventing stuff, actually, Philip Roth wrote a book. I think it's Philip Roth, and I could be lying. I could be mistaken. Some Jewish author wrote a book about being in Israel at the time when they put Jan Demjanjuk on trial. And that's who, like, that guy, Jim Trafficant, tried to save him. And if, in the end, the Jews actually let him off because he was innocent. They had accused him of being a character that was entirely invented, which was a Ukrainian guard at Treblinka. They called Ivan the Terrible, who was cutting women's stomachs open, like, eating the fetuses. You know what I mean? Like, all this awful. Like, seriously. No, I'm not. Like, there are stories like this. We've read them.
I believe those stories existed.
Right. And so they, and this is an entirely invented, like, character of the horrifying. It's fake. And of course, his name is Ivan the Terrible, right? So, like, Jan, Ivan, sure. Same name. And so this guy, and there was the evidence that he had been a guard, you know, in his youth, when he was in Poland in his youth, and that he actually covered that up in order to come to the United States, right? And the Jews got a hold of this information, which many people think it was actually a Soviet psyop, because they wanted to undermine the Jews and the Ukrainian nationalists working together, which is kind of an interesting thing. If you think about it, going all the way back then, the Soviets knew this was an issue, right? And to this day, it's still an issue. But they were actually, this is sort of their kind of shot. So they kind of planted this. This is one theory. It could be the Jews might have just done it on their own. Anyway, they grabbed this guy from America. He'd been living peacefully in America for like 40 years or something like that. Never hurt anybody, just on his own, like just totally fine, right? And he was in Jim Trafficant's district. They brought him, and they were just these crazy, like, insane stories. And some Jews were like, this is not going to fly. And they actually found him guilty, and then they appealed it, and they reversed it, and they let him go. But the Jews were going up there and in court, and they were just saying, like, the so-called Holocaust survivors, like, yeah, I saw him, like, eat a fetus. I saw him, like, cut ladies' stomachs open. And they were doing this to themselves. Okay. So that would kind of indicate, on some level, massive amounts of self-deception, because they're doing it in Israel to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this wasn't, and at this point, this wasn't good propaganda for them. Like that, like, there were some Jews that realized, like, this is not, unlike the Eichmann thing, this isn't working out for us. like, this one's not good. Like, we're gonna have to. Like,
also, yeah. Eichmann was uncoerced testimony, by the way.
Sure. Yeah. Sure testimony. Thing. Yeah. Because basically gaslighting the shit out of somebody and psychologically torturing them in a solitary confinement doesn't.
But I don't know. It's like, given what we know about like the Nuremberg trials, which I don't know, like, it's just like. Like at a certain point, didn't that one guy? There was some guy who was on like some history, some like Holocaust affirmer history check, who tried to say that the Speer confession was uncoerced. It's like you have a guy like how many years did he spend in Spandau? Like,
yeah, I don't know,
like the uncoerced confessions. Like, what's funny is he spends 15 years in Spandau, gets out, then a few years later writes a book saying, "Oh yeah, I knew it." Even though, like at the time, he said,
"Well, he went on talk shows and stuff in the 1970s, and because he was a very Speer was a real good looking, charismatic guy, so they put him on TV and they wanted him to say all of these things, and." And he was doing it, and then, of course, after he died, the Jews just, like, shat on him anyway. They're like, oh, yeah, he was always a piece of shit. Like, it's just, it's like, you can't win with these people. But, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that, I'll tell you this, when I did my debate with Matthew Cockrell years ago, he actually, one of the things he included in his evidence dump that he gave to me was what he considered uncoerced confessions. Right. And I didn't really respond to the confessions themselves. The argument I made was that you have, it was like 15 or 16, 18, some odd things in there, right? Not very many. Sure. And I was like, this is a implicit admission that everything else is coerced, Matthew. Like, I know you had to dig between the couch cushions for these. Now, I could challenge whether any of these is uncoerced. I don't think any of them were. I don't think there's any such thing. And Grumar made a point to me the other day. Where he's like, Matthew Cockrell is doing coerced confessions. He's like, Matthew Cockrell's coerced. He can't change his mind. He can't go against this and still have a career. He'll lose his spot at whatever university he's at, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, him debating
in terms of, like, the uncoerced confessions, like, now, I would say David Irving, like, his backtrack, I think that was a result of him.
He was coerced.
I think that was coerced.
Now, yeah, of course it was.
Irving did it. Yeah. Well, I think any reasonable person will come to that conclusion because his later arguments, his belief in the Holocaust, just seemed really weak sauce to me in terms of like coming back and saying, but also like Eric Hunt, that was coerced. That was clearly coerced. His going, oh, I don't believe it anymore. It's a dark place and all this stuff. Yeah. Like, that was coerced. This isn't the Holocaust. But what's his face? Heimbach. Heimbach's going from that was clearly coerced because he later came back and I think now he's starting to say like what he was saying before.
I know
that was clearly
personally coerced, you know? People so, who and like, who
it's
were
all, it's all but so the idea that like oh we live in an environment where you can speak freely now and they
no,
just were
we live in guilt. A we live in a comprehensively coerced environment on this stuff. Like the fact that I and you and I are the kind of people we are and are like where we are and that we are like massive exceptions to the rule on this. And what happened to Grumar Rudolph? Like Grumar Rudolph went to jail for years. Like he was extradited to Germany, went to jail for 4 years. Ernst Undel also went to jail in Germany. Like there's no non-coercion in this environment. Nobody's not coerced. And in the United States, it applies too. It's not the same as going to jail. It might actually just all things considered might be better. Cause you know, like on some level, particularly if you're going to jail in like Germany, would you rather be homeless, like jobless in America or in a jail cell in Germany? Like that's not an immediately obvious, you know,
correct. Yeah.
You know, which one you'd rather do. But, like it's all coerced. And like I said, Matthew Cockrell is coerced because he can't say otherwise. Cause Matthew, could you change your mind? You know, he's the History Speaks guy on Twitter. Could you change your mind and like still have your, and in fact, we know he's coerced also because he debated me and he got a lot of shit for that. Now he would say he won. I think I won. Shit, the whole debate devolved into a shit show. It doesn't matter. But he was supposed to debate Germar on like Jake Shields' podcast, and he said like his advisors, his academic advisors, told him like don't do that. So all right, so you obviously respond to coercion, Matthew. You obviously
like you're coerced.
Your career advisor said this will be bad for your career if you do that. and you didn't do it. So you are a coerced. So
yeah. So I don't know, like, when to ever like shoehorn this in. Because we're going off on things.
Yeah, I knew as soon as we started, we would just go. But yeah.
But one thing I've never heard anybody talk about this. It's like meat grinders.
Oh yes, I remember you sent me a post.
And I know it's like a very tasteless thing, and the videos are kind of like gory and gruesome. But it's kind of David Irving said this is like, you know, when you're talking about the Holocaust, you're talking about a very large amount of meat that needs to be disposed of.
Yes.
And so I was thinking about that because I was talking about this before. It's like, what if I was going to do, like, how am I going to dispose of the bodies or whatever? I'm thinking the piranha solution, but it's like, now the piranha solution is it's like an acid that they use. They don't send them to piranhas, but it's like acid. And they put them in a barrel and do that, but then there's
the acid. What are you gonna do with that? What are you gonna do with? Because nothing is destroyed, so it just turns into another state. What are you gonna do with that sludge? Whatever that human like acid.
Well, one, you can dump it in. Remember, they don't have genetic testing at the time, and they're not predicting genetic testing in the future or anything. It can turn into sludge, and you can turn it into whatever. But I'm just thinking, and like meat grinders, well, you can turn that compost that into fertilizer or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. But, like, yeah. Oh, in terms of, the people are dead, so why not actually just grind them up? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and because here's another thing. In the, like, all these Orthodox stories, like, they get burned in the crematoria, these super conspicuous crematoria in the middle of the camps or whatever, which takes hours, and these meat grinders. Now, these are modern meat grinders, but I don't think these are like really esoteric tech that the Germans didn't have. The German meat grinders at the time are probably a little less efficient or something, but it's not, I mean, you can look at them. Mm-hmm. They're not really super advanced things. They look like they could be from the 40s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So these are just chewing up these cows, like, which are a lot bigger than human, and like, a minute.
Yeah.
And like bigger ones can take entire so I'm thinking like, so in terms of like disposing and destroying large amounts of meat, why don't we look at if we're talking about a death factory, why don't we look at actual death factories?
Yes.
As in slaughterhouses. Like, maybe there's some clues there. It's like, and it's weird that I never thought about that, but it's like, But that's a make your own Holocaust argument, but the reason they say, well, the bodies were destroyed by the crematoria, it's because the crematoria is what they had was there,
because that's right? And they were killed with Zyklon B because that was there,
because that, and not carbon monoxide,
because that wasn't there,
because Zyklon B was actually there, right? And so
and of course the people making up these stories didn't know anything about like science, so like
they also didn't know about, and this is something that that Eric Hunt pointed me to. They didn't know about the actual the Degesh company that they sold Zyklon B, but they also sold like this machine that dispensed it and then heated it up. And
yeah, the actual way it was supposed to be done. Yeah,
right. And nobody in the chambers talked about that. So, I think in one of his videos, he actually found like an archival like. In one of these industrial like demonstrations.
I know
videos.
I've seen such a thing. Yeah. Maybe that was in one of his, or maybe it was Dean Irabod.
I'll ask him if he remembers where it was. Yeah. But yeah, it was one of these like old industrial like informational video. It was in German, but it was that kind of video.
Well, you can get the what's hilarious is you can get and even Jean-Claude Prissac in his book presented the entire like instruction set for using the Zyklon B, which was exactly the kind that like.
But then you have the story, like they're just shooting, they're just dropping these pellets down through this.
It's actually retarded. Like this is the thing. Like, this is my thing. It's like in a way, it's like it gets into the weeds, but like in a way, the weeds can be like helpful because if you're trying to tell somebody, like, no, listen, here's how they did it. And it keeps going and going. It's like, no, it's really, look, I get it. It's and then get let them start to be like, well, that's, how's that going to work? You know?
I don't think that is getting too much into the weeds. Maybe a little bit.
Well, I think just saying what it is, okay? Because it's like, okay, you don't know what it is. Like, now that could also hook someone, right? Because they're like, oh, yeah, I don't. It's like, no, I'm going to tell you what. Now, they might not believe you. A lot of times when I tell, this is the one thing, when I tell people what the claim, they just don't believe me. And I'm like, well, okay, then look at it yourself. And they're not going to, yeah. So that's a big problem, right? This is one of the problems.
I was talking to a person I was last holiday season.
Okay.
And I was telling them, and I was just saying like casually, like I wasn't even into like, you know, full denier mode. I was just mentioning that, like, I forget, just in passing, this mentioned, oh yeah, well, all the death camps were in the Soviet territories. I've just sort of casually mentioned that, and he was saying, no, and so I was saying, no, yes, it is, and he was saying, is this Holocaust? No, I'm saying, and at that point, I was just saying, like, this isn't even, this is like Orthodox history. I'm giving you I'm giving you like the narrative.
I'm just giving you the information. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but the thing is that sort of tells you just how powerful that argument, because that was the first thing that perked up my ears, was the East chip, because I sort of have an inherent skepticism of anything that comes out of the Soviet Union.
Fair enough.
And I think a lot of people do. I think even shit libs to a certain extent have.
Oh, for sure. No, yeah. The libtard enjoyment of the Soviet Union is vastly overstated.
Yeah.
The people that liked the Soviet Union were hard left communists, and they were just liars, and they knew they were lying, whether they were Jewish or not. You know, like, the liberals, like, stopped liking the Soviet Union probably in, like, this. I mean, everybody was told to like it in the war, and there's actually some hilarious propaganda videos that the Jews put out from, like, the where because they had to get over the fact that Americans didn't like the Soviet Union, and, like, people didn't like them European. Nobody liked it. Everybody kind of thought this was a bad place.
The Soviet Union didn't like the Soviet Union.
It was governed by, like, bad people. Like, pretty much everybody thought this. So it's sort of like the propaganda films, because there's a lot of Americans that are like, well, we're going to join it. Why don't we side with the Germans? Like, they're fighting the Russians. You know, like, why are we fighting with these? Why are we fighting with the Russians? This is a very common sentiment. This is another thing that's actually interesting is how. And I've like trolled people with this before, but I'm confident that it's true based on what I've looked at from public opinion, that like World War, like the Vietnam War was significantly more popular at the time than World War II was. At the time, like it was actually like more people, and of course the Vietnam people were polarized because they hated the anti-war protesters. Okay. But like, at, you know, still,
I need to plug an interesting book that the author sort of put out, like an. Like the first copy of the book. It's not it's almost like the modern, you know, release a game and then expect patches sort of thing.
Yeah.
But in it, he basically came to the conclusion that, cause apparently there was a US diplomat when Hitler gave the Reichstag speech saying, we recognize a state of war between Germany and the United States. A German diplomat actually contacted like the German consulate and said, was this a declaration of war? And he said, no, it was simply a recognition of the current realities.
Mm.
So it's not exactly clear that the Germans actually declared war.
No, I know what you mean. The idea that they declared war. Yeah, that's bullshit. Yeah.
But most of the book was actually saying that, mentioned, and he brought up a few newspapers about how the German declaration of war was actually not, it's actually a much bigger thing today than it was at the time. Like, at the time, it wasn't even.
Yes, and that's exactly true. At the time, it was literally like, well, we're basically at war with America too now, I guess.
Yeah.
It was sort of like that, yeah.
Because, yeah, so my, and I think he mentioned that most Americans knew. Like, the funny thing is that, like, early on, like in sort of like 1940, Roosevelt was actually running around with these, with like these charts about how the Nazis planned to invade South America and stuff.
Oh, and, yeah, like, they had all the kinds of crazy stuff.
And the U.S. public was just not believing it at all. It was just like, no.
Now, there's other...
That's retarded.
There's other funny stuff,
too. There's some time and space issues with that, Roosevelt.
Dude, there's so much stuff about the whole thing that's bullshit. Like, the speech is that Churchill gave. You know, people always say Churchill was like this eloquent, like inspirational orator. It's not true.
Like, yeah, and a lot of them were from like a double.
Yes, an actor oftentimes would be reading his. He would give his speech in the Parliament, which was not right. broadcast, and then later on, it would be transcribed, and then a voice actor would read it.
Yeah.
And then so there's no actual recording of his. We will fight them on the beaches. We'll fight. There's no recording of that, right? And so the recording you might hear is either an actor doing it or it's Winston Churchill himself doing it. Reenacted later that night because the BBC asked him to do it. So he read it from his office later that night and he was clearly fucking drunk. Because he's like slurring his words and he's like tired and is the least inspiring thing you can imagine. And you can find that and it sounds like shit. And it's really funny because you'll have people tell you, well, Churchill was this charismatic orator. It's like, have you heard him speak? No, you haven't, have you? You have no idea what he sounded like.
They might think they have. Because
they've seen it in a movie.
Yeah, they've seen it in a movie. They've seen maybe some History Channel thing.
They've seen on the History Channel picture of him with his top hat and his cane, and then someone saying that. So they think that they've seen it.
But there's also the fact that, like, at the time, like, the British public was not nearly as impressed by his, like, saying, "We will fight to the finish."
No, they didn't like it.
As Churchill was.
No, no, the Jews loved it, and Churchill loved it, but the British public was like, "Wait, isn't there someone you forgot to ask?"
Isn't there someone you forgot to ask? Like the people
they were like, "Wait,
the people who will actually be fighting and
So wait, like I'm gonna have to have my food rationed. I'm gonna have to melt down my garden gate and my. There's a song by the Kinks about this, how everyone had to melt down their garden gates and like turn in all their tin cans because they had to use them for weapons. Like literally, they're taking people's gates from them.
But there's also the people don't. I guess we're sort of getting into the myth of Hitlerite aggression here, but like I don't know. Have you actually read like the Munich Agreement? You can actually like read the. It's like really short. It's like one page thing. I don't. Have you read it? The Munich.
No, Agreement? I actually have not. Not like itself in the context.
It would take like. I mean, less than 5 minutes to read it. It's like bizarrely short, apparently Chamberlain is saying, and Hitler agrees to no further territory. That was not in that anywhere. Mm-hmm. It described like the mechanics of the Sudetenland.
And I've got it right here. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's like, and there's nothing in there that says. And so basically, what Chamberlain did. Is he like impressed upon the British public his hallucinations about what was in that agreement and then use the fact that Hitler didn't conform to his hallucinations as evidence of he's not trustworthy.
So yeah. Wow. This is wild. Anything he says. It's 8 paragraphs.
Yeah. It's very short.
I'm just going to read it here. It's not even 5 minutes. Agreement concluded at Munich, September 29th, 1938 between Germany, Great Britain, France, and Italy. Germany, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy taking into consideration the agreement which has already been reached in principle for the cession of Germany to Germany of the Sudeten German territory have agreed on the following terms and conditions governing the said cession and the measures consequent thereon. By this agreement, they hold themselves responsible for the steps necessary to secure its fulfillment. 1. The evacuation will begin on 1st October. 2. The United Kingdom, France, and Italy agree the evacuation of the territory shall be completed by the 10th of October. Without existing installations having been destroyed, and that the Czechoslovak government will be held responsible for carrying out the evacuation without damage to the said installations. 3. The conditions governing the evacuation will be laid down in detail by an international commission composed of representatives of Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, and Czechoslovakia. Occupation. This is actually, there's a lot here. I mean, it's not a lot, but it's getting boring. But like, it's very, very short, and I'm just skimming it. I mean, it's short for a diplomatic type document. The final determination of the frontiers will be carried out by the International Commission, it'll be in touch. I mean, it's funny because it's sort of like having gotten used to
now
looking into this stuff like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the claim that like the Palestinians are always the one that break it. It's just, again, not fucking true. But at least there's more there's more social acceptability to be pro-Palestine than pro-German. But yeah.
But also there's one little thing that's in there, which is that the apparently Hitler was and it's in there. It involves a plebiscite, and that plebiscite actually refers to certain territories in Bohemia and Moravia that were not part of the Sudetenland, but were either majority German or were generally considered that they would have voted to join with Germany at the time. Hitler did not act on that. Hitler decided, no, I'm not going to go any further. So that's an interesting thing.
The International Commission referred to in paragraph 3 will determine the territories in which a plebiscite is to be held. These territories will be occupied by international bodies. Until the plebiscite has been completed, the same commission will fix the conditions in which the plebiscite is to be held. Now, this is one of the things where they say, you know, the Jews and history always, oh, like, Neville Chamberlain, like, rolled over and he gave Hitler everything he wanted and that encouraged, like, more aggression. It's not really true that it encouraged more aggression. And what it was is my opinion, and when you're dealing with something like international diplomacy, I believe now you are dealing with people who consciously are lying. And Neville Chamberlain was lying. He was biding time because they were scared of Germany at this time, which is funny because Germany was much less armed than they thought.
Yeah. And that's what, incidentally, that actually undercuts the whole idea of, okay, so if you have somebody who's trying to avoid war, what are they going? So, if you have somebody who wants a war, like, you're going to get a war, what you want to do is you want to understate your military capabilities, but have a lot of it, so that other states will try to do things to get to war, right? But Hitler was doing the opposite, right? He was exaggerating the military, and right, so that's a sign of a state that doesn't want to actually.
And one thing is funny.
That just wants to bluff.
Yeah, one thing about that is also funny is that the Jews they obviously wanted other people to go to war, which they tend to do.
Yeah.
And so they almost shot themselves in the foot once again, to some extent, with their own overblowing of it, because they were making a big deal of how armed Germany was, and they were talking about how they were betraying Versailles, but it had kind of many historians have written this too. This is kind of a mainstream view. They actually they won't blame Jews, but like they'll say, like, you know, allies. They're like, they made the public scared. Like they made the British public hesitant because they kept exaggerating how big, powerful, and armed Germany was and how they were violating it, and they were, you know, and so people were like, all right, well, maybe just hands off then. Like, maybe we should just, like, you know.
Yeah.
And Jews get, one thing that is very consistent with Jews is they are always angry at the public for not being as warlike as they are, for being pussies, for being hesitant, for being appeasers. And that's why, you know, here's one thing. Here's a straight up, this is a normie argument I will just say straight up to people. The Holocaust has never been used for peace.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
And that actually hits people, because then they think about it and like, whoa. Yeah, I mean, you ever notice that? You only ever hear it. You only ever hear it talked about when America's looking to go to war against somebody who's obviously much weaker, right?
Right.
And obviously is not Holocausting anybody. So,
So they were trying to do that with Iraq, with the whole, and apparently the gassing of the Kurds, apparently that was bullshit.
Of course it was.
And they actually looked into, first off, it was like in like the battle line between Iran and Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. And apparently they looked at the gas that was used, and it was like a kind of gas that the Iranians used. So apparently the Iranians gas. Now, obviously they weren't targeting the Kurds. They were just there, and
And we're talking about, like, it was like a lot of this was like old school, like World War I tier stuff. They didn't, there was no gassing on purpose of Kurds. There was like there was a repression of them, absolutely, after his government was not, and this is one of the things they said, like, after we didn't sort of like finish the job in 91, he went and he suppressed any groups that were like going to be siding with America or with Israel, and yes, that happened, but that's it. Then why are you doing this? why are you doing this shit? If you, you know, like if you're not, so, because yeah. That's any government's going to do that. So, particularly, you know, these Arab governments, which are oftentimes the thin cover for tribal shit, right? So, right. Like ideology is a thin cover for tribal loyalty in the Muslim world. It's always what's funny when I see these people that have this like ideological anti-Islam thing. It's like, dude. You have no fucking idea what's going on. You have no idea what these people are like. But yeah, as if the Iranians are on like a world conquering mission for like Islam.
The
That's
axis.
Retarded.
They're the axis.
It's retarded.
The axis.
Palestine and Iran are going axis. To take over the world for Islam. Right.
They're the axis.
Yeah, and Lebanon. Oh yeah, Lebanon, Palestine, Iran. They are going to conquer the world for Islam, and you better watch out. And the only thing protecting you is Israel.
These regime, these, so that's kind of a weird, like, how to, like, is the belief in like insane regimes,
yes,
like an irrational,
yes,
regime.
That's that comes like, out like, of World War II too. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Like because if you, yeah. But the thing is, anyway, the whole Munich Agreement is really important because it sets up, you know, it sets up Poland. Apparently, yeah. I didn't know this, but apparently, like in Polish newspapers. They were bragging about how they were like public Polish newspapers were bragging about like how they were like attacking across the German border, mm-hmm, with impunity, like, yeah, like in newspapers, like, yeah, they were just saying this outright. It's like, it's really wild the kind of like what the Poles were doing. And they were like, and like German civilian aircraft that were flying from Pomerania to Prussia, like being fired on by anti-aircraft guns.
I mean, you know, it's funny because that stuff is like more remote in history, but of course then, you know, we like look to history now and the way that, you know, these Middle Eastern governments and stuff are talked about, and it's obviously ridiculous. Now granted, when you're talking about like an actually fully industrialized, wealthy, powerful European state, that maybe there's more credit, sort of inherent credibility of a big military buildup and being very strong. Yeah. But it's just like, you know, I don't know. It's just like the same. Well, that's what's sort of the funny thing is that, like, it's obviously not credible to compare a state like Iraq to Germany. But they did it anyway, you know, right. And like and because they're not. And of course, what's funny is liberals at the time were actually criticizing this. I remember as like a young man who was like an anti-war activist, and I didn't stay on the left long. I found like the libertarian, yeah, anti-war right, and I found much, much more at home with them, and their arguments were much better. They were much more convincing, at least to someone like me. And liberals were eternally, because there were certain things that libtards would always be doing that I was always like, this is stupid. Why are you? And of course it was because they were actually being subverted by Jews in their own ranks, like Al Franken and other Jews that were like kind of controlling what the lib narrative was. We're sort of like, right, always leaving the door open. But and like never just saying, nah, this is bullshit. Like, because everybody was saying that, but the lib media wasn't saying that. And it's funny because there are people that were conservative. This sort of goes to the how people like invent memories, right? And maybe I'm doing it too. But, you know, Jesse was a conservative at the time. And he was, right, like pro-war because he was a conservative. He was listening to like Rush and watching Fox and stuff. And I, yeah, was a liberal, or I was anti-war. At first started, like, I was anti-war and then became, like, an anti-war libertarian. And he had this memory that, like, the whole media was against the war. And I was like, that's not really true, though. Like, they weren't. And I know because,
no, not at all,
because I was against the war, and I was analyzing the media coverage and stuff. And he's acknowledged that, yeah, he was in, like, a thing where he was listening to people tell him that. He wasn't actually watching, yeah, the media, right? He was listening to Rush Limbaugh, right, say all the media is against it and we have to go, and the media and the UN and the, you know, the whole thing that they do, right?
Yeah.
And so it just, even like people still, like, you not dumb people who are not dumb, like this stuff works on them. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a true believer, like, neocon. I was like, oh, yeah? Literally I was the worst person. Literally
you and you and Jesse fucker. Would actually. I was like that too.
I was like Fukuyama, end of history. Like, this is the glorious crusade for democracy. Take down Saddam. I don't care if he has WMDs or not. Take
really?
Down the dictatorship.
That's
the new liberal order. Yeah, I was.
Wow.
I was full full Kool-Aid, full
So you were American probably Enterprises. Like of the opinion that like I don't care if he doesn't have WMD, we have to do it anyway.
Exactly. Oh yeah.
Which is I actually think what most pro-war people thought. Because I don't think that if you could convince them, I actually am of the opinion that a lot of people that were actually ideologically for the war were like, I don't give a fuck. Because Jesse's told me this too. He didn't believe it. He didn't believe the WMD thing.
I think I believed it.
Well, he told me, maybe, who knows? Because also people invent things or they don't remember properly, right? Because his memory of his position was, I knew that I just didn't care about WMD because I was like, who gives a shit? Like, this is the excuse that we're using because we just want to do this and we just got to get it done. And like, people need to shut the fuck up. Like, that was his attitude. And my attitude was like, I
recall that as my attitude too.
Yeah, that seems to me more plausible as what somebody's attitude would be, because I can't imagine, because it's, if you think about it, it's actually a hard case for you to stand and tell people you really think that Saddam Hussein is going to gas you or something. Right? Yeah, you really think it's kind of dumb, right? Stuff. It actually is kind of stupid. So tell me, like, if you live in like New York, or you live in like, you know, the West Coast, even worse.
Or he's going to invade Saudi Arabia.
He can't even do that.
He's going to attack Israel. He's going to attack Israel.
Well, he attacked Israel once we attacked him. You know, that's when once we attacked him, he started sending scuds there. He actually did, and some of them hit. He wasn't doing it before. You want to know what's funny is, this is actually hilarious. One of the things that was also considered a weapon of mass destruction was any munition that could hit Israel. So when they did the UN prescribed weapons list for him, like, it wasn't just chemical, biological, nuclear,
like particularly long range artillery from like the very tip out in the middle of nowhere, that could hit
potentially him. Yes. So the weapons inspectors went in, and you could find this stuff, and Scott Ritter, who is not trustworthy in some respects, but I don't doubt this is true. He's not my only source on this though.
I don't like Scott Ritter because he's always going on about, like, and the Russians want denazification of Ukraine.
He also has been so fucking wrong about that war.
Yeah.
And, like, how quick the Russians are winning now, but it's going to take them 4 or 5 years to win, you know, like that. He was like, they're going to win. Like, they're going to surround all the Ukrainians and be over. And none of that was true.
I thought that too.
I was looking at
how fast the map was changing color in the initial invasion, and I'm like, oh, this is Poland 39.
I thought so too. And also another thing that biased me in the wrong direction this time was my disbelief in all things the US government talks about how things are going. Like, my tendency to just think they're always lying. When in fact the Ukrainians were like incredibly well prepared army, like, which I didn't know that. I should have known that. I should have been looking at it closer. It was really embarrassing, but I did believe that kind of shit at first, and it only took me like a few months, and I was like, oh yeah, that's not true.
I think it's really coming out now what's happening. But I think even like in middle of 23, like, there was data coming out about the artillery shell ratio.
That's something I've been following that for a while. Yeah, that was.
And I was following that, and I was thinking, okay, so if the Russians are firing like 10 times as many artillery shells, they probably have 10 times as much of other things. They're probably getting something like a 5-to-1 ratio. That was my thinking at the time.
Well, the other thing is that.
We're still in the war, so the fog of war, the numbers aren't coming out. I mean, there's little leaks here and there, but I don't know how trustworthy they are.
It's hard to know. I do know that now they are absolutely sort of snowballing right now. The Russians are kind of
getting harder to conceal,
which is what a war of attrition does, right? Like, it's like, logistics, all wars are won by logistics. They're not won by heroics. They're not won by tactics. They're won by who has more stuff and which is better stuff. And we all get that, right? That's a lesson I had to learn. Ukrainians, and this is the thing about the Western propaganda, at least.
The NATO wonder weapons are like, can like 1,000 to 1 better than anything.
Yeah, see, that's not true. But they also then talk about like the individual like heroism of the Ukrainians versus like the cowardice of Russians, and I'm like, well,
I think that's
bullshit. And I know that there are Ukrainians that have like absolute brass balls and have absolutely gotten themselves fucking killed for stupid shit, and that's sad. Sure. But like, here we are. But
I think it's also kind of shown, like, it's at least toned down a lot of the, like, the more extreme beliefs in NATO wonder weapons.
Oh, yeah.
How much better Western tech is than sort of...
Which is never...
The Russian-Chinese blob tech is.
Well, it also just shows the doctrine of, like, you know, U.S. doctrine of war is not actually ready for this kind of a thing. I mean... And one of the things I've seen, and this is sort of now we're getting kind of away from the Holocaust a little bit, but it's still just fun to talk about. The Americans, like, one of the things, first of all, the whole split, like Trump splitting with NATO, that's all bullshit. Like, none of that's real. What we're doing is trying to get the Europeans to like just dedicate 5% of their national budgets. We're trying to get them to remilitarize because they were demilitarized after World War II for, you know, reasons of the Jews disarming their enemies, right? Which was the European continent. And so they were disarmed. Europe was disarmed and humiliated, all of it, not just Germany, all of it. Even England and France.
Especially England.
Yeah. And so they were all made colonies of Pax Americana or Pax Judaica, Pax Judaic America, whatever you want to call it. And now over time, the sort of the hubris or whatever capitalist weapons procurement, I don't know, however you want to talk about it, we focused on so much more high tech and like long range, and you know, like we just don't have the amount of basic level stuff. And
that was an issue in Vietnam.
Yeah, and so then the Europeans have emptied it out. I mean, I remember getting like South Korea to find to dig up like artillery shells to send to Ukraine and such, and like they even took some from Israel, which I was like, that's crazy. But as it turned out, it wasn't the Israelis; it was a U.S. stockpile in Israel, and of course, we immediately like refreshed the Israelis. Because you have, and again, what's funny is like, well, do the Israelis even need artillery because they're not fighting other tanks? Well, of course, because they just blow the shit up out of everything. Like they don't. Yes, they're fighting a lightly armed militia, but they don't give a shit about that. They just fire artillery into... I saw this video, this guy, Brian Berletic, who does all the analysis of how much gear. And he was talking about this sheer density.
Is he the Norwegian guy?
No, he's he's American.
Go ahead.
But he was talking about just like the sheer density of artillery fire that the Israelis dump on air. He's like, no one else does this. he's like the Russians will use this for the entire line of contact, and the Jews will do it for like one neighborhood in Gaza City.
Yeah.
And it's just like these most fucking vicious people, man. It's crazy what these people are capable of. But I mean, that's why I consider them like the real enemy. Like they're just the most vicious people. Like they don't give a fuck about anything. That's like, they are absolutely savage. And they're liars, they're savages, they're dangerous people, man. But anyway.
Thing that I've actually been doing that I've done that I haven't really seen done much is I'm actually working on a paper on like Jewish population.
Yes.
My wife told me to ask
you about this, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So previously I wrote an article called The Jewish Population Miracle. And I think in that article, I don't think I said anything that you could say is like strictly speaking wrong. However, I think I said too much.
Okay.
A little bit too much.
My wife told me that she had asked you to if she could publish your, because Germar is always looking for original research.
Yeah, and I said I'm not sure. I think I may have. I think I told her I may have done something wrong.
Yeah, she told me you said you wanted to clean it up.
Yeah, because I think I made an assumption that I personally think is correct, but is not actually founded, and that has to do with the U.S. TFR. Because what I'm doing with the thing is, I don't know Okay, so anyway, so basically, to start off, I point out what's par. So, yeah. What is par for the Jewish? Would we expect? We would expect something like, I think it's 1.15 million Jews to die if they died at the same rate as everyone else. So,
okay, start at the beginning. What do you mean, par for what? Par for.
So, in terms of the countries where Jews were at the time.
Okay, how many would we expect to die over this period of time?
Based on how much everyone else was dying.
Okay, all right.
So if they're dying at the same rate as everyone else,
proportionally, yeah.
That's not a sign of any targeted extermination program of them.
Yes,
so we would expect about 1.15 million. So if you can't get above 1.15 million, you don't have a special case, at least from the population.
Well, I think now, you have a special case that they were particularly unharmed, which is what I actually think is the truth, but yeah.
I personally believe that, but again,
it's hard to establish, but yeah.
Just limiting ourselves to the population numbers, you can't look at the population numbers, say 1.5 million dead Jews, Holocaust. No, because that's the same rate as Belarus, Poland, and where they were clustered sort of in the Pale of Sodom. Right. So that's sort of par. And then I look at I separate out the contemporary and the revised estimate. So first I look at the contemporary story. Now the contemporary story is basically impossible. That write-up is, so the contemporary story is basically the population estimates from the AJC at the time. So for 1945, that would be the 1944 estimates. So to get the year, it's the next year's edition tells you how many Jews there were in the previous year. And they were saying something around 11 and some change million in 1945. At the time, I believe it was something like 15.7 million that there were pre-war in 1939. And then there's no estimates in between them. And then 1945, they say it's 11 and some change million. Now, but then if you just go with the contemporary estimates, now there's a later change in method where they back revise all these populations, but the contemporary estimates have the Jewish population going up to about 14 and a half million. And that's sort of, then it sort of flat lines from there. And that 14 and a half million is achieved in, let me look at this. Okay. I'm going to go entirely off memory here. I have all this memorized. Where is it?
I have your links here.
Yeah, it starts to sort of, in 1975, it's 14.23. In 1980, it's 14.527. So it starts to go flat around 1975-ish, right? That's when it starts to peter out. Now, so you have...
the Jewish population growth starts to peter out around then.
Yeah, so you start to have you have two explanations for this. One is big Jewish population growth, okay. Another is there was a big Jewish diaspora, and it just took time for them to track them down, right?
Right.
So, because really, what we're looking at is the number of Jews that the AJC was able to count, right? Strictly speaking, that's what it is. And I also linked in sort of my LinkedIn evidence of states today that either fabricate or have difficulty estimating how many people are in their state in modern states. And I point to one in the United States where the U.S. Census is having disputes between how many people really are in Minnesota, for example.
Well, this has been
in the U.S.
This has been an issue in the U.S. Census, particularly, of course, this thing, it's predictable. The headline says Black and Native American, Latino Black Native Americans. And these are less compliant populations, and frankly, Jews are not compliant populations now, particularly Orthodox Jews. That's a hard group to count.
Isn't there something in there, either, I don't know if it's in the Old Testament or if it's in some other Jewish writing that says don't be counted?
Yes, I believe that. I don't know if it's in the Bible, but it's definitely somewhere, and I've read, or I was fooled by something that's fake, but I don't. It seems like something possible they would say, and I also know that Orthodox Jews are more numerous than we think, and also non-compliant with basically everything. I mean, they were clashing with the government about COVID stuff. they fight with governments until they beat them about local zoning regulations. I mean, and
they turn everybody
into Palestinians, man. They basically, they fucking, in Rockland County, New York, in this town called Ramapo, they basically got like 51%, and then they voted all themselves onto the school board, and they basically voted themselves all the public school funds. And then they sold the public school buildings to themselves.
Right.
And like just cut, and they, and then they, all the, all school taxes go to busing their Jewish kids to yeshiva. And so like white people just all left, and the only people left that aren't Jewish are just like blacks, because they're not gonna, they don't care, they don't get, they don't do anything, right?
Aren't there like, yeah, and then don't they have like their own special ambulances that won't
pick got their own ambulance service, and it's called Hatzalah. New York City allows it to exist. They have their own police in New York City called Shomrim, which it's not, they're not allowed to do arrests, and they're not allowed to go armed, but you better fucking believe they go armed. And and if they, they don't necessarily do arrests, but they will detain, and they will wait until the actual NYPD shows up. And a lot of times the NYPD might release somebody to like actually like get them away from the Jews. Like, you better get out of here. You know what I mean? Because
I think I saw something. I don't know if it was Netanyahu saying this, but when they were doing the COVID lockdowns in Israel, like there was some statement that went out that basically said, like, and don't try to play games with the letter of the law. Follow the spirit of the law, okay?
Like, yeah, no, because they, even in Israel, they were non-compliant with COVID stuff. And when the actual, like, the secular police and IDF and stuff would show up, and they would start calling them Nazis and shit, and they, it's crazy. Dude, they're fucking, those people are like a fucking cancer. Like, they are cancer. I actually think Israel is doomed, ultimately, because of those people.
Aren't they, they're exempt from conscription, too.
Which is a problem. Because they're also the most vehemently pro-war, right? So if you have a crazy religious population that is pushing the country into war and doesn't serve, that's fucking nuts. I don't even know how they, how that...
Well, hey, that's the U.S.
That's true. That, it's the U.S., but it's the thing is, Israel's a smaller country, and it's a country where everybody's involved in politics because they're Jews. Everyone's Jewish, so everyone's involved in politics, right? That's the thing. That's why the thing is, Jews, the way that they are, have to be parasites. Israel is not a long-term entity. And you know, Hitler was right about it when he said, you know, it's not, they're not going to go there and live like normal people, like other people, even a small country. They're not going to live, they're going to go there, and it's going to be a, like a criminal base. And and that's what it turned into, and that's what it is. So it's sort of like, they cannot live like other people. They just, they don't actually have any working. I don't think people in Israel even have jobs. That's probably an exaggeration, but like they don't have very much of a working class at all. And the Jew, and they have this massive population. You know, it's funny. You talk about welfare queens. I mean, these people, you know, and in some level, like the U.S. props up Israel. So of course, then these 1 to 2 million people who just study Talmud and Torah all day, who don't work jobs, they're propped up by us too. So it's, dude, it's the whole thing is fucked up, dude. But I think that population group is going to tear. It's not like Jews will be solidaristic with each other against all others in any case, but just the inherent flaws and weaknesses. And they're also not very intelligent, right? They're not as smart as the other kind of Jews, as the more secularized Jews.
They're creating
dysgenics among the Jewish community because they're outbreeding them. Now, secular Jews actually are some of the most fertile, middle class, wealthy people. But
in Israel,
in Israel, in America, they follow the same patterns, I believe. But Orthodox Jews in America follow the same patterns as Orthodox Jews in Israel, and they just breed like fucking rabbits. They also don't do, now, if you want to get into parenting styles, RK selection theory or whatever, they're the low investment parenting. Like Orthodox Jews are low investment parenting, which seems counterintuitive at first, but they breed just like broods.
You have to be low investment if you're breeding broods.
Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine, because there's certain parts of the United States where you are adjacent to their communities, and they will come at certain, they're literally like locusts or something. They come in at certain times of the year and leave in others. A friend of mine grew up near like one of their camps, and he's like, they literally one time just found a Jew kid in their bushes. Called the police because there's like a toddler in the bushes. And the police, right. They're like, all right, they knew it was Jew. The Jew had the things on it, and so it's obviously a Jewish kid.
Right.
Like, all right, you gotta take this off our hands. Like, we don't want to deal with it. And so the police took it and they took it back. I mean, who knows whose it was, right?
The parents just don't care. The parents just like let their kids run around on people's.
I think there's enough of them they lose track. I don't think they totally don't care, but they don't discipline their kids or they let them go wild. Yeah, so.
Okay, so I'm throwing stuff at you in Twitter. So the one, there's that video that I talked about previously. And I also linked to an article that talked about, that goes into some stuff on Jewish fertility, particularly in the United States. And it's this table, scroll down, there's a lot of stuff.
So how about this? Really... Start from, like, what is the crux of the argument you're making?
So the crux of the argument is that Jewish TFR from 1945 to 1980.
Total fertility rate?
Any TFR is well below what it would need to be for the contemporary estimates to have been true.
Right.
In fact, it's probably, I think, the problem is we don't have the age distribution going into 1945, so we don't know how young or how old it is. And the thing is, the TFR before the war is going to impact the population going into the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Mm. The TFR in the 30s matters going all the way through. Because if that number is smaller, then, you know, a high TFR later is going to be of a smaller population that comes out of that. So there was a Jewish baby boom. It was a little bit smaller than the white baby boom, but there was a Jewish baby boom in the U.S. And of course there's a Jewish baby boom in Israel.
Yeah.
But
there's one going on now for sure. But, I think there's a Jewish baby boom in the U.S. going on too, but that's another,
but
no one else is, not, but I think they are, but yeah, that's, I don't have any evidence of that, but yeah.
not in the U.S., the USSR. It's like, it was like 1.5 during this period. And in Europe,
right.
It's a little bit more, it's a little bit less.
So yeah, the important thing is, so the idea being that, given,
but the thing is, all together, and I did, and I weighted them for the populations at the time over these years, and I did one recently. It came out to 2.177, but that's not including any effect of the pre-war Jewish TFR in the U.S., which is like 1.5.
Right.
So the pre-war Jewish fertility was very low. Then they sort of followed the baby boom in the U.S., which pumps up the U.S. Jew fertility number, but I'm not factoring that in, kind of, because I don't really know how, because I'm not a demographer and I don't really know.
But Jews weren't Holocausted though, right? So I mean, I guess so. The argument is sort of like, if Jews really lost 6 million of their population, they couldn't possibly have the number of people they have today. This is the argument, basically.
Basically. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No. That makes a lot of sense. That's a very difficult thing to establish. But I totally, because the number of Jews is hard to establish. I've actually read books, older books, revisionist books, where guys have tried to tackle this thing and throwing their hands up because they're like,
what I'm going to say right here, basically, if you assume a flat age distribution, which I think is generous based on the pre-war TFR numbers, it probably wasn't flat. It was probably older. It was probably annuated. But even if you assumed a flat age distribution, it requires a 3.04 TFR to go from 11.3 to 14.5. And basically, even though the data is like very messy and low resolution and stuff, it's magnitude. It's so much that would have to be done that there's basically just no way. What I'm saying for the contemporary numbers.
So
can you
give like general numbers? Like, so you're estimating what, like there was 11 million left after the Holocaust?
No. Okay. So my opinion. Okay. So here's just my opinion. I believe there's about 15.6 million Jews in 1939. After the war, there are about 14.5.
Okay.
And that basically flatlined.
Right.
And they basically had replacement fertility average overall worldwide. That's my view. That is why once you hit that number around 14 and a half, that's when the number of Jews in the world that were counted by the AGC began to flatline, because basically it took them about 35 years to start to be able to reestablish their counting of the number of years. That it wasn't actually.
One thing I've said, and I've noticed now, I've tried to establish this, and I've been able to, if I'm correct, I think the number I've been able to get is around, from memory, about 600,000. I could say that this definitely is the case, where the population count in Israel, there was a British mandate. They had, of course, they had caps on immigration and such, but the Jews were violating that all the time. They were smuggling people in the time, and they were not getting counted by the British. So the British had censuses of the Arab and the Jewish populations. And in the years, in the couple of years after the state of Israel is established, they don't need to hide those people anymore. So now those people are citizens of Israel. So the population jumps after 1948 very quickly, like by 600,000 or so, very fast.
Right.
Now, could be immigration, but I think a lot of it is also like Jews that were just there, and the Israeli government is now just going to count them because they're citizens now, right? They're no longer hiding their the fact they're just... Now, you'd also need to go more into this and look in year over year, because I know that the fact is that the population of Israel absolutely in the first few years goes up very, very quickly. And they'll attribute it to immigration, but I don't know if that's true or not, you know? Because 600,000 immigrants to a place like Israel, and like after that's a lot, you know, even given ideology and given how comfortable Jews were everywhere else in the world, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think they were emigrating. They weren't emigrating from the U.S.
Certainly not.
Yeah.
But
at least on net. So,
but even,
so anyways,
but the claim is they were like people that weren't killed by the Holocaust. But my point is that I think there are some of the, where did they actually go? Because this is the one thing they always tell you, is they challenge you to this. It's sort of like, well, you guys now need to tell us where they went. Because if you can't, then that means the Holocaust is definitely true, which is, of course, absurd. But, you know, I think it's some level, I'm like, that's kind of a, because you can't really tell me either. Because we also know, like, you don't even know yourselves, because we've looked at the Yad Vashem database, and they have errors, and they've got duplicates in there, and there are people that are alive.
Like, there's a guy, like, a funny story. They put in Joseph Goebbels' wife in there and said she was Jewish.
Well, Stryker did an article that I helped him with, like, a couple years, like, several, I'd say, like, 3-4 years ago now, maybe, like, 4 years ago, on his old website. I don't know if I could find it anymore, but I know about the, I think I could, at least an archive of it. And we looked at the database, and we found, like, famous Holocaust authors were in it. So Yitzhak Arad, who wrote one of the main Holocaust books, like one of the canon books about it. His real name is Isaac Rudnicki, and he's from a certain town in Poland. And he was in there like 4 times.
Wow.
Yeah, he was in the Yad Vashem. He's not there now, but when we looked, he was there. We were looking up like famous Jews that promote the Holocaust narrative.
Wow.
And they were all in there.
Well, so he's an he was Holocausted 4 times.
He was killed 4 times.
He was an expert, right?
Yeah, that's why I knew so much about it.
There you go. Dude, I remember. Dude, that was funny.
They there's two Jews of that name from that town. And I'm like, yeah, okay, there might be two Jews of that name, but from that town at that time? Come on.
I mean, probably, yeah. And given the existence of other known double entries and fake entries, probably.
But also, even if it's not him, it's still a guy named Isaac Rudnicki from the same town in Poland in there 4 times. Like, that's true whether or not it's that guy or not, you know?
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
That sort of reminds me of, I forget, this was one of, like, the very early things that caused me to, like, have skepticism about the Holocaust, was when someone told me that in Elie Wiesel's book Night, which I remember in high school, they made us read, no mention of gas chambers.
There aren't any mention of gas chambers in it.
And I was like, and I was sure that there were. Memory told me that there were. Because, and obviously that's memory conflation. I'm conflating that what's in that book with other things I've read. So, but then I went through it, and this is before like you could have AI to just say, "Hey, read."
Well, it's not that long. I mean, you could actually skim it, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, but I did. I skimmed through it and I was like, "Oh my fucking god."
When was this about?
1954.
When did you do this?
Probably 2020, 2021. Okay.
Cuz we were we started doing a lot of Holocaust content right about that point, like 2019, 2020.
Maybe you mentioned it.
It might have been because that was the talking point we were talking about, because that's when I started reading all those books.
But that one was the East Shift, all the death camps in the Soviet zone of territory. Okay. Now for me, I'm obviously inherently skeptical of anything Russ, but like I saw that, I'm like, whoa, hello, like this is, you know,
and that in a way you can almost exploit Americans like distrust of anything Russian with that one. You know, because it might not, it's probably not fair to Russians, but we are basically programmed to just like not like them.
But then also the stuff where like Stalin like prohibited, you know, Western investigators into the camps. It's like, and that's where the Holocaust persists to this day. That was like huge.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't have even been Stalin. It would have just been the Polish government, because that's where everything is. And what's funny is Germar Rudolf, when he was, you know, he's writing the Holocaust Encyclopedia, he talks about how much he was rethinking some of the ideas of like the, based on the research he was doing, because he was like Carlos Whitlock Porter Holocaust, like written in Nuremberg, or written in Russia
made in
Russia, right? And he sort of like was rethinking something. He's like, actually, I'm not seeing a lot of evidence like the Polish government was behind this, right? And of course, we know like 1946, or maybe people don't know, 1946 was like when the communists took over in Poland, and it was heavily Jewish. In fact, Kevin MacDonald in his new version of Culture of Critique has a whole appendix to the chapter on Jews and communism I don't think that was in the original one, about Jews in Poland. It's fascinating because they were, again, I always knew that that was a really, really Jewish and really, really one of the worst communist regimes was in Poland from like 1946 to 1968. Interestingly enough, Israel is always tied up in everything. It's amazing because one of the reasons Stalin, by that point he was gone, 1968, but one of the reasons the Soviets and then the Gentiles in the Polish Communist Party, they started purging Jews, was because they were all pro-Israel. And Soviet foreign policy was pro Arab in 1968, and so like that was one of the things that actually led to the purge of Jews from the communist government in Poland in 1968 was they were traitors on this important issue. So it's crazy, and when he found that was like they were some of the main that the Polish and I was like oh the Polish government I was like you know they're mostly Jewish, and of course he's sort of defensive on making those kind of accusations. So he's like, yes, it is, but also there was non-Jews in the government too, and they were saying it too. And I'm like, yeah, but we know as soon as you get 25-30% of Jews in something, they're running it, and people are going to be the vocal minority effect and game theory.
So you have 30% Jews, and then they can get another 20% of butt-goys. Now they got a block.
And if you're doing something with communism, where like dissent is even like is not even part of the system, you know, like in America, like it's bent on like, you know, the American system requires like the pretense of disagreement. Communism doesn't do that. So like you're just getting everybody going along with it, right? So at least at first, right? In particular, and in the most important years, right? Because the power of the Jews waned, and the population became suspicious of them, and of course it was they were absolutely brutal and punishing, you know, ethnic revenge, like all these communist governments.
It is like recently, I want to say like in the 2010s, like I forget who it was. Was it the was it like the Polish government or the Auschwitz? But there's some group that was basically that was like a meaningful group in Poland that basically said, yeah, the idea that the Nazis like Holocausted Poles or Holocausted Catholics or anything, which was like a huge part of the Soviet Holocaust story, not the Western story.
Mm.
It's funny. The Western story is predicated. It's all in the Eastern camps, but the Western story was all about Jews. Mm. But in the Soviet Union Warsaw Pact, it was Soviet citizens,
was what they said.
Yeah, they retained the diversity of victims. That kind of phased out earlier in the West.
Right.
But apparently, that recently, like in Poland, they're now apparently saying that no, it was all Jews. Like the idea of Polish victims, that's all bullshit.
Well, the Jews are saying that. Here's the thing.
But I need to find that though, because that's important, because it's like, because it goes into like most well documented thing, but just like no.
Well, again, one thing you could talk about is how the claim that it used to be that there were 5 million Poles and Russians or whatever killed, and then of course, because that 5 million is also big, but it's not quite as many as six. And then Simon Wiesenthal basically admitted that he made it up on a phone call.
Right.
Yeah. Like he basically admitted that, and then no one talks about the 5 million anymore. And I remember even when I was younger, I could be inventing it because people do that, but I feel like I remember when I was a little kid hearing about that as well. Hearing about 5 million million Jews and the 5 million non-Jews. I feel like I heard about that when I was in school.
I very much recall hearing 11 million total.
Yeah. I remember it, right? But given that it's not part of propaganda today, it's probably something that we both did experience. But the conflict in Poland is thus, that one of the major bulwarks of the legitimacy of the state in Eastern Europe is the defeat of the Germans. And it was true for the Soviet Union, and it remains true for Putin's Russia, and it was true for Poland, and it also remains true for the modern Polish state, even though they're like enemies with Russia, right? They're not friends anymore, but the Germans being bad, big, bad, evil people. And now the Poles also see the power and legitimacy that being Holocaust victims grants you. And the Polish government, the communist and the non-communist, and now the Western oriented, the NATO Polish government still does that. Because of course the Americans, everyone's the Holocaust, right? Everyone's doing it. So this is sort of like a fact of all the major powers in the world today are just in a consensus about this one thing, which is interesting because now they're just accusing each other of being it.
Right. Yeah.
But so the Poles want to retain the validation of being victims of the Holocaust, right? So they do. They actually passed a law that actually says, and of course, Jews being Jews, eventually they started saying Poles were collaborating with the Germans. That's illegal to say in Poland,
which they probably were. But
low key, that's more plausible than otherwise. But again, they weren't collaborating with them to like gas Germans, but they were collaborating with them. Well, first of all, we know that Poles accepted German military occupation. There was a resistance, but it was largely Jewish, and it was largely communist as well. And they had like the whole government in exile in London and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like everyone after the war was in the French Resistance.
Right, which I maintain the French Resistance was like the Underground Railroad in America. It never really fucking existed.
Right.
The French Resistance particularly didn't exist. There was a Polish Resistance. So the whole conflict is that. And then the Poles, the Jews wanted they started really pressing. And this all went by the wayside with the Ukraine war because the Ukrainians, the Polish were so cooperative against Russia that these sort of demands were dropped or put on hold. And I think also the conservative party, which is called like PIS, like PIS, I don't know what that stands for in Poland, which is very Jewish. Right. As always, if you go and look at a meeting of their top officials, it's all the little yarmulkes are there, even to this day, just like with the liberal parties.
The yarmulkes.
Yep. They passed this law that says like it's illegal to this is illegal to blame the Poles in any way for the Holocaust. And of course, there was Jewish Holocaust historians that were like writing books about this and making cases about this, and just to show you how actually sort of like ethnically
let me interject here. I think that would render a certain amount of Orthodox Holocaust history in the West illegal in Poland.
Yes, it does. That's a problem.
But anyway, Anyway, continue.
So this created a problem, and so most of the Holocaust historians were like Americans, or then some of them were Jews in Poland, or there would be like American scholars that like can't travel to Poland because their book is now effectively illegal there. And so there was, and so America was putting, and it's weird, right? Like, here's this Polish, like, national pride law. Poland's always been a good ally since the, you know, whenever they joined NATO, the right. Soviet Union, they've always done everything. This is another colony of ours now, right? And the Americans right. like putting all this pressure on them to, like, no, you actually have to humiliate yourselves. You have to let the Jews come in and blame your population for collaborating with Nazis. You have to do that. And it was because, like, the ADL was complaining about it. Holocaust scholars were complaining about this law. And it also, they actually started targeting Poland because this is how in concert with each other they really are. There was something that they wanted, which was some kind of reparations, where they had this idea of how much Jewish property existed prior to World War II in Poland versus how much exists now. And so, and they wanted I swear to God, like, I know, right? Fuck the fuck off, right? But they were right. like, given that like 30% of real estate in Warsaw was in Jewish hands, and today it's only 10%, we're going to need that made up. And this is, now that law was wild. They wanted this passed in Poland as a law, like something like right. this, right? Wildly unpopular. Like, insanely unpopular amongst all the people in Poland. And anti-Semitism, as you can imagine, went up in a population already probably kind of primed for it, given their history, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then on top of that, so that was like, then in service of this, wanting this, the Jews started doing this propaganda about, oh, the Poles weren't victims, they were participants. And then the Polish government was like, no. And of course, there, as always, there's going to be Jews on both sides of this argument. There's going to be Jews like, "Oh, we agree with you, Goyim. You can't let them do this," you know. So, that was what that conflict was about. Yeah, I actually might have made some errors, but I have a Polish friend who will probably browbeat me now. The guy Polish takes, you go by Hot Polish Takes, Polish Connection on Twitter. He knows all about it. We did a show. But yeah, he knows all about it. But it's complicated, and I hope I told it right. He'll probably get angry at me, but yeah,
yeah, yeah. Broad strokes.
But that's basically, Jews wanted reparations from Poland. In service of these reparations, they started doing Holocaust stories about the Poles actually were killing the Jews with the Germans. Well, and the Poles told them, hey, back off, you can't do that. Yeah.
Dude, that's okay, but this is actually very powerful. This is actually, yeah, so I'll look into that a little bit more, because that seems to be a pretty powerful, might be a pretty powerful argument, because it shows just how...
It's just a political tool, right?
Yeah, how the Holocaust is like this political football, and they're talking about changing the narrative, but the horse trading on changing the narrative is based on like all these,
based on giving Jews like money and property, right? It's like
right,
yeah. And it also shows like it's not just political; it's like extortionist. It's like
most well documented, like, and also like again most well documented event ever, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
and then like. Yeah.
Right, and of course the stories were like, the stories would be like, oh, like Jews and Poles were burned by the Nazis in this village, and some Jewish historian comes along like, I actually looked into it. It turns out the Poles helped the Germans just burn the Jews, and it's like, none of this is fucking true. Yeah, like that just never happened. That just never happened at all. Right.
One, and that probably never happened. But also, one, my guess is like the actual like anti. If they limited it to this, it would actually sort of be a little bit believable, at least like to someone like me, like who cares. But if the Holocaust story was always just like when the German army came in and like blasted through an area, they created a period of anarchy, right? Mm-hmm. Before the military government could be set up and all that, right? And in this period of anarchy, like Slavic people would have like free reign on the Jews.
Yeah.
That's actually a little bit believable. Well,
there's arguments that happened in like Ukraine.
Especially in Ukraine. Yeah, yeah. Ukraine is particularly what I'm thinking about.
Some people will say that did happen. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
There's actually evidence that the Germans tried to restrain the Ukrainians from doing it. But yes.
Yeah.
Because they just wanted, they just wanted order. They also knew the Ukrainians were kind of like unruly people.
Right.
Like the extent of Ukrainian Nazism is exaggerated. Like, you know, the they put Stepan Bandera and all of his lieutenants in Sachsenhausen for like 4 years. They didn't trust him at all. Like, these people are not trustworthy.
Well, Bandera, I think, was kind of a lunatic. But
the Germans definitely thought so.
But they had a lot of volunteers. They had a lot of volunteers. From
yes. Like, yeah, the Ukrainians.
Well, they had more volunteers, like, as a proportion of even the pre-war population, let alone whatever it was when they were actually occupying it after it had been picked over and stuff. And they had a higher volunteer rate from the occupied Soviet territories than the volunteer rate into the U.S. armed forces in World War II.
Right. And Ukrainians like to fight.
From an area that's war-ravaged and, yeah.
Well, first of all, Ukrainians like to fight and they don't like Jews. But the funny thing is that this, it also kind of just, generally speaking, throws shade on the whole thing, to the fact that America is just completely willing to look the other way. Not at the actual political program, but at just the symbolism. And I've read, like, articles by like Jews who will just be like, yeah, we know how it looks, you know, talking about the Ukrainian or the Azov and some of the other like volunteer forces, which now are just part of the army. Like they actually are some of the best parts of the army now, because they're the most ideologically motivated.
Right.
And Jews are like, we get these are good cannon fodder. Shut
just
up.
Let it go.
Just
also,
let it go.
They're not really.
They're also all gonna. They're all gonna die. It's fine.
One, they're all gonna die, but also they're not even. First off, to the extent they're quote unquote Nazis, they're Bandera Nazis.
Yes.
Whatever the fuck that is. And two, Nazis were never real. Like, you know what it's kind of like? I see it as kind of like Jesus. I'm so, mm-hmm. sorry to push this on it, but okay. Like people will say, like, well, Jesus really existed. He was a real person. And it's like, sure, maybe. I don't know.
I think there was a cult leader that existed. Yeah, I think it's a good
idea. Sure, whatever.
I think it's hard to explain without that, but yeah.
But that's kind of like, but that's not the guy.
Right.
That's not the Jesus.
There's like, nothing that's written
that's
about.
That's a guy named Jesus from Nazareth. That's right. Not the guy. And that's sort of the same way I see sort of like Hitler, as like there was a guy named Hitler, but he's not that guy.
Oh, no, the guy that did stuff. No, I mean, he was a certain way, but he wasn't that guy. Yeah. Obviously, Hitler was obviously a very impressive person. He wouldn't have been able to do what he did otherwise. Like, because them talking about, oh, he's got like one ball and he had all these neurological disorders. That can't possibly be true. And also the whole idea, even the fact that he's like socially awkward.
Maybe Nick Fuentes believes all that stuff.
He sees himself in that, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's, oh, so he couldn't reproduce? Okay. No, but I think that it's like, it's just not credible to me that he would have been, like, how can you be that charismatic and impactful of a speaker, which is, that's true. That he was, and then be like a weird autistic, you know, I don't know. Like, he obviously had a huge impact on people that he came in contact with, because what he was able to do, people, it's not credible that he was any of these things. Yeah.
Like, everyone who spoke to him found him like wildly charismatic. It's also interesting, like, if you read, like there's, I don't know if you've seen those AI speeches of Hitler, where they like, and it's like, you listen to it in German and it just sounds like weird German noises. But then, like, you listen to the Englishized version, and it's like, he's actually like a very, like,
oh, it was making a lot of sense. But
I mean, it doesn't really impact. I mean, it didn't really impact me because I'm such a weird, like, autist on like data and stuff, so it's not really that compelling to me. But I could sort of see how, like, it really is.
My one complaint about it is that Germans speak in a like a higher register than English speakers do, and so he sounded for an English speaker, he sounded a little bit high pitched. They should have brought it down like an octave or something, so he had a more deeper resonant voice. But
like, even as it was speaking in English, he sounded. And also, what was it? Yeah, what was the other thing they were saying? Oh, yeah, that he didn't go through puberty all the way.
It's just nonsense. That's fucking retarded. Yeah, someone known for his mustache didn't go through puberty. That's just, shut up.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Just be quiet. Like, just stop. And okay. It wasn't like he only had this one. Because you see pictures of him from the war, and it was like this jaunty, you know, as was the fashion at the time, he had like the jaunty handlebars.
Oh, yeah, those excellent. Those excellent 1910s mustaches. Those wonderful.
You know, everybody was rocking those back in the day. You know, that was the fashion at the time. But, So, yeah, I don't know.
Okay. What was I talking about?
We were talking about
the Jewish population.
Yeah, the Jewish population. Yeah.
That's okay, so let me just. I'll just.
We're coming up on 3 hours, so we can finish off after this.
All right, all right. I'll just finish up quickly. Okay. So one thing that happened. So basically, the contemporary story basically requires about a 3 TFR, and there's not a whole lot of evidence of that. It's basically everything points to about a replacement
level. Yeah.
A fertility, and also the if you look at the TFR, it looks like a replacement level of fertility. And then if you look at the Jewish population that was counted, it flatlines at about 14.5 million, which is about 1.1 million less than 15.6 million. So which points to, about 1.1 million died.
Right.
That's about par.
Yeah. I also think that Orthodox Jews, which are more populous now than they were back then, but
But you don't even need to get into that.
Yeah, I know. You're right. You're right. No, I tend to overanalyze it because they are more of them than we know. I think even back then there were more Jews than we know.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't really matter because they would be invisible both before and
that's
after.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Right.
So.
Well, they would be sort of like invisible to the data, but they're visible. They're visibly there. Now,
all I can see is the data. So
right. So question, like, what do you? Because from the Soviet Union, my understanding is kind of like a black box on this. But is it? I don't know.
So the Soviet Union, we have TFR from the Soviet Union, and it's like the lowest. And there's no baby boom for Jews in the Soviet Union. I pixel counted this little chart from one of D.B. Polio's paper, and I got 1.47, 1.44, 1.4. It's all right around 1.4 something, which is itself a little bit suspicious. Like, it's very regular. There's no shifts like there are in these other countries. So that's one issue.
Well,
and also the number of Jews in the Soviet Union is 2 million. It's 2 million, 2 million, 2 million. And then it goes up to 2.268, 2.486. So the Jewish population is going up with a TFR of well below replacement. So that's a fun story.
That's
interesting.
Now, another element of this, which maybe is not...
I don't believe in any of those.
Maybe is not relevant, but I believe that one of the things... one interesting thing you could glean, this may be relevant to the Holocaust somewhat, but also just relevant generally to the Jewish issue... In the Soviet Union, I would imagine, particularly in the early years, you're going to see numbers, population numbers, and fertility numbers and stuff for all groups, going kind of haywire because of the revolutionary upheavals and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and then for the Jews to remain steady. Now, McDonald, his chapter on Jews and leftism in his new version, it's like 100 pages of like really fine print. Pretty dense pages. It takes a few, 2-3 minutes to read a page if you're reading it for comprehension, right? So it takes a while to get. It's not a slog, though. I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
But the part about the Soviet Union is like about 25 pages. But he details like every ethnic group that received some kind of fucking shit. Like, and Jews weren't one of them. So, because he's got it, the fascinating section is like the Bolshevik Revolution is ethnic warfare. And so this is something I've always believed, right? That didn't last. Jewish rule in Jews abandoned communism. Jews were eventually they went afoul of communism. They became in conflict with it. So it's sort of this is one of the things funny to talk about because there's some people that are like convinced of this. Jews are communists and that's why they're bad. And I'm like, no. Like Jews created communism, sure, or they created Bolshevism and the Bolshevik Revolution. That's why you think. Communism is so bad, but then like everyone hates communism. Yeah, well, we hate it too, and it was bad. it's like what the fuck? fuck? So yeah, they absolutely it absolutely was them in the Bolshevik Revolution, and every ethnic group was just getting fucking decimated in the literal sense of the term decimated, and yeah. they were growing, or at least staying steady, and they became the elite. They were like, just like here, yeah. it's crazy. Like, even though whatever they were running all the radio stations and the media, and it's just like, dude,
yeah,
it's fucking crazy. But anyway.
Well, it's because they're so much better at
they're it. They're just, that's anyway. Well, because they're prevented from doing other things.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Anyway. Well, anyway, like before the war, I mean, Germany only had like what, 250,000 Jews. Poland had 2 million Jews, and so that's why the Polish economy was like booming, you know, in the 20s and 30s, right? Because they had all these brilliant Jews.
Yeah, it's very smart.
That's why Polish medicine is so amazing. And well, just to finish off, one thing you have to keep in mind, because when I cite the contemporary estimates, those are not the estimates you'll see on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia uses revised estimates and it was from a methodological shift in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did two things. First, there was a 1948 revision. This occurred in 1948, and it basically bumped up the 1939 Jewish numbers from 15.7-ish to like 16.7-ish, right? So it bumped the 1939 numbers up by about a million. So that's revision one. They're bumping up the 1939.
Yeah, I've seen that. They've seen this in there's yeah. stuff going back where I've seen people make. There was an erroneous claim made.
And then they lower the Jewish numbers into the 1970s and 80s. So, but right. the 1945 numbers, they're certain about that. There's no revision for the 1945 number. So.
Well, again, now another thing I think might be convincing. Or at least, if not convincing, infectious is the 6 million number itself.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
there
always,
is.
Yeah,
I mean, interestingly enough, I always thought that was sort of like I tend to shy.
6 million Jews, six the prophecy.
Well, but I've always heard of. I've always sort of shied away from things I consider like numerology or. Too spooky, you know what I mean? Like, I don't like that kind of stuff. Like, I don't.
But we're not making that argument.
But
bringing that up, we're not saying that it's like a spooky numerology thing that happened in the real world. We're saying that's why that number was chosen, because
yes.
the propaganda.
So the issue is what you're doing. But this is why I used to hesitate on this argument, because the people telling me were like, "Oh, there's some prophecy of this or that." Now. I don't even know if there is. I've heard something that's something like there's a million. There's like some math in the Talmud or something. That might be true. But one thing we know is that the number is used. That is documentable. Oh, that it was used for decades and decades before, and even today. Like, why did the AIPAC just tweet that they have 6 million members?
Yeah.
Like, first of all, that opened them up to the attack.
Right.
Just to the ridicule of it. But secondly, I looked, and on their own Twitter account in September, I literally remember this, because I made a tweet on this like 3 days ago. On September 7th, 2025, they tweeted they had 5 million members. On November 23rd, they tweeted they had 6 million. I'm like, that's an impressive recruitment rate.
Yeah.
Like, that's really big recruitment. That was you're doing big numbers, AIPAC. Like, where are you getting all these people from?
Yeah.
So obviously these are just made up numbers, right? But but why would you say? And I'm like, are they just again imprinting the 6 million numbers in people's brains?
I don't think it was a top down conspiracy. I think it's just that's the number people started saying it, and they sort of went with it, and it just and. I don't think it was like a plan.
I think that no, nor do I. I think that I don't even think it's actually like that at all. I think that the 6 million number was inertia, because they had used it so much before.
Right.
Like, they had used the 6 million Jews in danger, 6 million Jews in danger for so long that when they started talking about how many were killed, they're, oh, it was 6 million. Like, yeah. That's what I think actually happened.
Yeah.
Now, I do think the Holocaust is a top-down conspiracy, but it's also not. Like, I think it's both at the same time, right? Like, it was a bunch of dumb shit that eventually became a top-down conspiracy, you know?
Sort of.
Effectively, like,
well,
for lack
off,
of
like
a better
the
way.
The anti-German war, I mean, they had, like, the PSYOP. They had the whole mechanism of propaganda from the West and the Soviet Union all converging on Nazi Germany at the time. So.
Right.
So in that way, it was sort of, and these PSYOP operations we're perfectly happy to go along with anything.
Yeah. And of course, so much stuff is based on like Polish underground reports, like Polish resistance underground, which is just, you throw all that in the trash as far as I'm concerned. Like, I don't believe a word of it. Right. And nor should anybody, and any reasonable like historian should at least be like, oh, these are interesting.
And the people writing it was like, we're writing it from the death camp.
Right. Yeah. Like, also, I'm in Auschwitz and look at what I'm seeing. It's like,
oh, I also linked another thing. I want to grab the talking stick. Grab the stock talking stick for just a second. I linked to something. This is a really like sort of basic level argument, which is the kind of stuff that I like. This is a map, European population density 1910. I found maps that from later. From like the 30s and stuff, but they didn't have like the same sort of resolution.
Which one is this?
Is from etc.usf.edu.
Okay, yeah, so I figured that would have to be. Okay, yeah. I'll bring that up.
But you can see like where Danzig is, and then go down from Danzig down to sort of the Katowice, Auschwitz, Gliwice area down there, and it's like it's one of the more populated areas in Europe.
Okay. You won't be able to see it, but the listeners will. I've got it up now. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's of course where they put their biggest death camp, right? 1.5 million Jews, you know, killed there.
Mm.
So that's another one of these sort of probabilistic, I can build to get a better, not a better gas chamber, but a better death program, a better mass murder program. It's like, so that's where they're going to put, like, that's where they're going to kill all these people, right? In an area that populated. Not anywhere, like, you could just go a little bit further north to either the west or a little bit over to the east.
Well, that's the other thing is little generally,
field out here.
This map isn't even almost, like, too much because, like, the fact is that Auschwitz, like, the Oswiecim, Auschwitz, Monowitz, it was a whole industrial... Like, it wasn't out in the country. Like, this is, it was a, it was a,
like they're killing people in the building, like, next to.
Right. Like, why do they have so many, like, because if you look at, actually, the Birkenau camp, now Auschwitz one is small, and actually, some people look at it, like, that looks pretty nice. Like, there are, like, slums in America that aren't that nice. But when you look at Birkenau, that wasn't quite as nice. That was also built, Like, Auschwitz, the first camp was built, that was a, Polish built that. That was already, it was pre-built. That was not the Germans did not build that. They did build, and it didn't hold that many people. They did build Birkenau, which had barracks after barracks after barracks, just like building after building after building to house people. And why? To kill them? No, because they were working in factories around in the surrounding area.
The synthetic rubber.
Yes, the Bunov plant, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big, and there's a lot of coal in that area, which is why they put it there. Another funny thing I saw was apparently there was like this message where like some, like 900 something Volga Germans came from the Soviet Union when they're at war, and they actually housed them at Auschwitz temporarily before figuring out where to settle them within Germany. So, I mean, that doesn't... Now, an L2 Orthodox person isn't going to be fazed by that argument because they'll go, well, you know, they did that, but that doesn't mean they weren't also killing people there at the same time. But, you know...
Yeah.
But for an L1 person, that's kind of like, huh?
Like this huh? L2, L1, so, I'm sorry.
Were they exterminating the Volga Germans there? Like,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So for L1, that's a little bit of a,
I don't know. The one argument I use to final thing is when they say like, and again, this is only for L2s, but it does trip them up when they talk about like, you're saying that they went east. Like, where did they go east? Like, no one ever went east. I'm like, really? Majdanek is to the east.
One, Majdanek is to the east, but there was also
Latvia is to the east.
I need to find that. There's like this map. That show that it was funny. I think it was from USA Today or maybe Daily Mail or something. But they had like this map that showed like basically what was occupied Soviet Union, just pockmarked with what they called them Jewish ghettos throughout the occupied, but like these ghettos were like in the middle, of nowhere. So, so they're not like ghettos as people think of them. But it's, so it's like, where did they go? But the funny thing is, like, this article was bringing up this research as evidence of like the Holocaust or something. But I guess like the reporter, doesn't really understand. Like right. the shot that like, no, people supposedly weren't, that was supposed to be a euphemism for killing. But then this reporter apparently stumbled upon this and went, oh
yeah,
Germans doing things with Jews must be evil.
Yeah, it must be evil. Like, oh, look at this. They had the killing camps set up in the USSR ready to go, or they were going to
like 1,000 killing camps all throughout Belarus and Ukraine.
I don't think that's what that was. They were planning killing camps in Madagascar.
That's right.
They were going to put gas chambers there. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how the naive... but again, none of it matters, really, in the end, because people don't know what the Holocaust is. So, like, this is the kind of stuff, like...
Well, that's step one. You have to tell them what it is.
Right, and
you have to show them, like, no, this is, like, official. Here's the map from USHMM. Right.
If they're willing to, if they're willing to listen to you that long, but yeah, tell. I mean, just the. I think that the biggest flaw in it, in the Auschwitz gas chamber story, just can't be true. It's impossible, and asking people to, just telling people that, I don't know. That's what I like to do, and like I said, anytime an L2 wants to debate me, which is rare, it's rare these days, but I will do it if I can. You know, anybody that wants to actually debate this, I will do it, but they don't really want to because they tend to bluff because they think no one knows anything and they think that they can just rely on,
right. Which is usually true.
Usually people are dumb. Most random people memeing about the Holocaust on Twitter, again, they probably don't like Jews. They're probably racist. They don't like Jews and they probably don't think it's true, but they couldn't defend that. They don't know anything. Right. But that's also why people should definitely go to armreg.co.uk and get some books. I am not just advertising them. I'm also a client. You should see my bookshelf. There's like 30 of these volumes, which I've read some of, at least all of them. And some of them I've read all the way through. But I know there's some weedsy in the weeds arguments that I like. But again, I'm talking to the audience of the, I'm talking to a choir. And it's also just for my, I like to cover what I like to cover. So I think all the arguments are good. But anyway. This was fun. I'll put this up.
Okay, yeah,
we've
been going on for
it's
longer than I thought we would.
It's like 3 hours. My voice is starting to get, I'm starting to get a little
raw.
But
And you talk all the time, so
that's
true.
So. That's true. I talk quite a bit. But we can do it again. I'm happy to do this again. If you get that stuff on the population together, just whenever you want. Like I don't mind.
Because
I do have to do one show all by myself, so having a guest always helps. But
all right, well, excellent.
All right, man. All right, well, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a while, and hopefully, everyone, the listeners, will have all enjoyed it, and we'll just see everyone later.